North and South. Chapter 1. Haste to the wedding. "Edith," said Margaret, gently, "Edith." But, as Margaret half suspected, Edith had fallen asleep. She lay curled up on the sofa in the back drawing room in Harley Street, looking very lovely in her white muslin and blue ribbons. If Titania had ever been dressed in white muslin and blue ribbons, and had fallen asleep on a crimson damask sofa in a back drawing room, Edith might have been taken for her. Margaret was struck afresh by her cousin's beauty. They had grown up together from childhood, and all along Edith had been remarked upon by everyone, except Margaret, for her prettiness, but Margaret had never thought about it until the last few days, when the prospect of soon losing her companion seemed to give force to every sweet quality and charm which Edith possessed. They had been talking about wedding dresses, and wedding ceremonies, and Captain Lennox, and what he had told Edith about her future life at Corfu, where his regiment was stationed, and the difficulty of keeping a piano in good tune, a difficulty which Edith seemed to consider as one of the most formidable that could befall her in her married life, and what gowns she should want in the visits to Scotland, which would immediately succeed her marriage. But the whispered tone had latterly become more drowsy, and Margaret, after a pause of a few minutes, found, as she fancied, that in spite of the buzz in the next room, Edith had rolled herself up into a soft ball of muslin and ribbon, and silken curls, and gone off into a peaceful little after-dinner nap. Margaret had been on the point of telling her cousin of some of the plans and visions which she entertained as to her future life in the country parsonage, where her father and mother lived, and where her bright holidays had always been passed, though for the last 10 years her Aunt Shaw's house had been considered as her home. But in default of a listener, she had to brood over the change in her life silently as heretofore. It was a happy brooding, although tinged with regret at being separated for an indefinite time from her gentle aunt and dear cousin. As she thought of the delight of filling the important post of only daughter in Helstone Parsonage, pieces of the conversation out of the next room came upon her ears. Her Aunt Shaw was talking to the 5 or 6 ladies who had been dining there, and whose husbands were still in the dining room. They were the familiar acquaintances of the house, neighbors whom Mrs. Shaw called friends, because she happened to dine with them more frequently than with any other people, and because if she or Edith wanted anything from them, or they from her, they did not scruple to make a call at each other's houses before luncheon. These ladies and their husbands were invited, in their capacity of friends, to eat a farewell dinner in honor of Edith's approaching marriage. Edith had rather objected to this arrangement, for Captain Lennox was expected to arrive by a late train this very evening, but, although she was a spoiled child, she was too careless and idle to have a very strong will of her own, and gave way when she found that her mother had absolutely ordered those extra delicacies of the season which are always supposed to be efficacious against immoderate grief at farewell dinners. She contented herself by leaning back in her chair, merely playing with the food on her plate, and looking grave and absent, while all around her were enjoying the mow of Mr. Gray, the gentleman who always took the bottom of the table at Mrs. Shaw's dinner parties, and asked Edith to give them some music in the drawing room. Mr. Gray was particularly agreeable over this farewell dinner, and the gentlemen stayed downstairs longer than usual. It was very well they did, to judge from the fragments of conversation which Margaret overheard. "I suffered too much myself, not that I was not extremely happy with the poor dear general, but still disparity of age is a drawback, one that I was resolved Edith should not have to encounter. Of course, without any maternal partiality, I foresaw that the dear child was likely to marry early. Indeed, I had often said that I was sure she would be married before she was 19. I had quite a prophetic feeling when Captain Lennox," and here the voice dropped into a whisper, but Margaret could easily supply the blank. The course of true love in Edith's case had run remarkably smooth. Mrs. Shaw had given way to the presentiment, as she expressed it, and had rather urged on the marriage, although it was below the expectations which many of Edith's acquaintances had formed for her, a young and pretty heiress. But Mrs. Shaw said that her only child should marry for love, and sighed emphatically, as if love had not been her motive for marrying the general. Mrs. Shaw enjoyed the romance of the present engagement rather more than her daughter. Not but that Edith was very thoroughly and properly in love, still she would certainly have preferred a good house in Belgravia, to all the picturesqueness of the life which Captain Lennox described at Corfu. The very parts which made Margaret glow as she listened, Edith pretended to shiver and shudder at, partly for the pleasure she had in being coaxed out of her dislike by her fond lover, and partly because anything of a gypsy or makeshift life was really distasteful to her. Yet had anyone come with a fine house, and a fine estate, and a fine title to boot, Edith would still have clung to Captain Lennox while the temptation lasted. When it was over, it is possible she might have had little qualms of ill-concealed regret that Captain Lennox could not have united in his person everything that was desirable. In this she was but her mother's child, who, after deliberately marrying General Shaw with no warmer feeling than respect for his character and establishment, was constantly, though quietly, bemoaning her hard lot in being united to one whom she could not love. "I have spared no expense in her trousseau," were the next words Margaret heard. "She has all the beautiful Indian shawls and scarfs the general gave to me, but which I shall never wear again." "She is a lucky girl," replied another voice, which Margaret knew to be that of Mrs. Gibson, a lady who was taking a double interest in the conversation, from the fact of one of her daughters having been married within the last few weeks. "Helen had set her heart upon an Indian shawl, but really when I found what an extravagant price was asked, I was obliged to refuse her. She will be quite envious when she hears of Edith having Indian shawls. What kind are they? Delhi? With the lovely little borders?" Margaret heard her aunt's voice again, but this time it was as if she had raised herself up from her half-recumbent position, and were looking into the more dimly lighted back drawing-room. "Edith! Edith!" cried she, and then she sank as if wearied by the exertion. Margaret stepped forward. "Edith is asleep, Aunt Shaw. Is it anything I can do?" "All the ladies said poor child." On receiving this distressing intelligence about Edith, and the minute lapdog in Mrs. Shaw's arms began to bark, as if excited by the burst of pity. "Hush, Tiny. You naughty little girl. You will waken your mistress. It was only to ask Edith if she would tell Newton to bring down her shawls. Perhaps you would go, Margaret dear?" Margaret went up into the old nursery at the very top of the house, where Newton was busy getting up some laces which were required for the wedding. While Newton went, not without a muttered grumbling, to undo the shawls, which had already been exhibited 4 or 5 times that day, Margaret looked round upon the nursery, the first room in that house with which she had become familiar 9 years ago, when she was brought, all untamed from the forest, to share the home, the play, and the lessons of her cousin Edith. She remembered the dark, dim look of the London nursery, presided over by an austere and ceremonious nurse, who was terribly particular about clean hands and torn frocks. She recollected the first tea up there separate from her father and aunt, who were dining somewhere down below an infinite depth of stairs, for unless she were up in the sky, the child thought, they must be deep down in the bowels of the earth. At home before she came to live in Harley Street, her mother's dressing room had been her nursery, and, as they kept early hours in the country parsonage, Margaret had always had her meals with her father and mother. Oh! Well did the tall stately girl of 18 remember the tears shed with such wild passion of grief by the little girl of 9, as she hid her face under the bedclothes, in that first night, and how she was bidden not to cry by the nurse, because it would disturb Miss Edith, and how she had cried as bitterly, but more quietly, till her newly seen, grand, pretty aunt had come softly upstairs with Mr. Hale to show him his little sleeping daughter. Then the little Margaret had hushed her sobs, and tried to lie quiet as if asleep, for fear of making her father unhappy by her grief, which she dared not express before her aunt, and which she rather thought it was wrong to feel at all after the long hoping, and planning, and contriving they had gone through at home, before her wardrobe could be arranged so as to suit her grander circumstances, and before Papa could leave his parish to come up to London, even for a few days. Now she had got to love the old nursery, though it was but a dismantled place, and she looked all round, with a kind of cat-like regret, at the idea of leaving it forever in 3 days. "Aunt Newton," said she, "I think we shall all be sorry to leave this dear old room." "Indeed, miss, I shan't for one. My eyes are not so good as they were, and the light here is so bad that I can't see to mend laces except just at the window, where there's always a shocking draught enough to give one's death of cold." "Well, I dare say you will have both good light and plenty of warmth at Naples. You must keep as much of your darning as you can till then." "Thank you, Newton, I can take them down, you're busy." So Margaret went down laden with shawls, and snuffing up their spicy eastern smell. Her aunt asked her to stand as a sort of lay figure on which to display them, as Edith was still asleep. No one thought about it, but Margaret's tall, finely made figure, in the black silk dress which she was wearing as mourning for some distant relative of her father's, set off the long beautiful folds of the gorgeous shawls that would have half smothered Edith. Margaret stood right under the chandelier, quite silent and passive, while her aunt adjusted the draperies. Occasionally, as she was turned round, she caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror over the chimney-piece, and smiled at her own appearance there, the familiar features and the usual garb of the princess. She touched the shawls gently as they hung around her, and took a pleasure in their soft feel and their brilliant colors, and rather liked to be dressed in such splendor, enjoying it much as a child would do, with a quiet pleased smile on her lips. Just then the door opened, and Mr. Henry Lennox was suddenly announced. Some of the ladies started back, as if half ashamed of their feminine interest in dress. Mrs. Shaw held out her hand to the newcomer. Margaret stood perfectly still, thinking she might be yet wanted as a sort of block for the shawls, but looking at Mr. Lennox with a bright, amused face, as if sure of his sympathy in her sense of the ludicrousness at being thus surprised. Her aunt was so much absorbed in asking Mr. Henry Lennox, who had not been able to come to dinner, all sorts of questions about his brother the bridegroom, his sister the bridesmaid, coming with the captain from Scotland for the occasion, and various other members of the Lennox family, that Margaret saw she was no more wanted a shawl-bearer, and devoted herself to the amusement of the other visitors, whom her aunt had for the moment forgotten. Almost immediately, Edith came in from the back drawing-room, winking and blinking her eyes at the stronger light, shaking back her slightly ruffled curls, and altogether looking like the sleeping beauty just startled from her dreams. Even in her slumber she had instinctively felt that a Lennox was worth rousing herself for, and she had a multitude of questions to ask about dear Janet, the future, unseen sister-in-law, for whom she professed so much affection, that if Margaret had not been very proud she might have almost felt jealous of the mushroom rival. As Margaret sank rather more into the background on her aunt's joining the conversation, she saw Henry Lennox directing his look towards a vacant seat near her, and she knew perfectly well that as soon as Edith released him from her questioning, he would take possession of that chair. She had not been quite sure, from her aunt's rather confused account of his engagements, whether he would come that night. It was almost a surprise to see him, and now she was sure of a pleasant evening. He liked and disliked pretty nearly the same things that she did. Margaret's face was lightened up into an honest, open brightness. By and by he came. She received him with a smile which had not a tinge of shyness or self-consciousness in it. "Well, I suppose you are all in the depths of business, ladies' business, I mean. Very different to my business, which is the real true law business. Playing with shawls is very different work to drawing up settlements. Ah, I knew how you would be amused to find us all so occupied in admiring finery. But really Indian shawls are very perfect things of their kind. I have no doubt they are. Their prices are very perfect, too. Nothing wanting." The gentlemen came dropping in one by one, and the buzz and noise deepened in tone. "This is your last dinner party, is it not? There are no more before Thursday?" "No. I think after this evening we shall feel at rest, which I am sure I have not done for many weeks, at least, that kind of rest when the hands have nothing more to do, and all the arrangements are complete for an event which must occupy one's head and heart. I shall be glad to have time to think, and I am sure Edith will. I am not so sure about her, but I can fancy that you will. Whenever I have seen you lately, you have been carried away by a whirlwind of some other person's making." "Yes," said Margaret, rather sadly, remembering the never-ending commotion about trifles that had been going on for more than a month past, "I wonder if a marriage must always be preceded by what you call a whirlwind, or whether in some cases there might not rather be a calm and peaceful time just before it. Cinderella's godmother ordering the trousseau, the wedding breakfast, writing the notes of invitation, for instance," said Mr. Lennox, laughing. "But are all these quite necessary troubles?" asked Margaret, looking up straight at him for an answer. A sense of indescribable weariness of all the arrangements for a pretty effect, in which Edith had been busied as supreme authority for the last 6 weeks, oppressed her just now, and she really wanted someone to help her to a few pleasant, quiet ideas connected with a marriage. "Oh, of course," he replied with a change to gravity in his tone. "There are forms and ceremonies to be gone through, not so much to satisfy oneself, as to stop the world's mouth, without which stoppage there would be very little satisfaction in life. But how would you have a wedding arranged?" "Oh, I have never thought much about it, only I should like it to be a very fine summer morning, and I should like to walk to church through the shade of trees, and not to have so many bridesmaids, and to have no wedding breakfast. I dare say I am resolving against the very things that have given me the most trouble just now." "No, I don't think you are. The idea of stately simplicity accords well with your character." Margaret did not quite like this speech. She winced away from it more, from remembering former occasions on which he had tried to lead her into a discussion, in which he took the complimentary part, about her own character and ways of going on. She cut his speech rather short by saying, "It is natural for me to think of Helstone Church, and the walk to it, rather than of driving up to a London church in the middle of a paved street. Tell me about Helstone. You have never described it to me. I should like to have some idea of the place you will be living in, when 96 Harley Street will be looking dingy and dirty, and dull, and shut up. Is Hellstone a village, or a town, in the first place? Oh, only a hamlet, I don't think I could call it a village at all. There is the church and a few houses near it on the green cottages, rather with roses growing all over them. And flowering all the year round, especially at Christmas, make your picture complete, said he. No, replied Margaret, somewhat annoyed, I am not making a picture. I am trying to describe Hellstone as it really is. You should not have said that. I am penitent, he answered. Only it really sounded like a village in a tale rather than in real life. And so it is, replied Margaret, eagerly. All the other places in England that I have seen seem so hard and prosaic looking, after the New Forest. Hellstone is like a village in a poem in one of Tennyson's poems. But I won't try and describe it anymore. You would only laugh at me if I told you what I think of it, what it really is. Indeed, I would not. But I see you are going to be very resolved. Well, then, tell me that which I should like still better to know what the parsonage is like. Oh, I can't describe my home. It is home, and I can't put its charm into words. I submit. You are rather severe tonight, Margaret. How? Said she, turning her large soft eyes round full upon him. I did not know I was. Why, because I made an unlucky remark, you will neither tell me what Hellstone is like, nor will you say anything about your home, though I have told you how much I want to hear about both, the latter especially. But indeed I cannot tell you about my own home. I don't quite think it is a thing to be talked about, unless you knew it. Well, then pausing for a moment, tell me what you do there. Here you read, or have lessons, or otherwise improve your mind, till the middle of the day, take a walk before lunch, go a drive with your aunt after, and have some kind of engagement in the evening. There, now fill up your day at Hellstone. Shall you ride, drive, or walk? Walk, decidedly. We have no horse, not even for Papa. He walks to the very extremity of his parish. The walks are so beautiful, it would be a shame to drive, almost a shame to ride. Shall you garden much? That, I believe, is a proper employment for young ladies in the country. I don't know. I am afraid I shan't like such hard work. Archery parties, picnics, race balls, hunt balls? Oh no, said she, laughing. Papa's living is very small, and even if we were near such things, I doubt if I should go to them. I see, you won't tell me anything. You will only tell me that you are not going to do this and that. Before the vacation ends, I think I shall pay you a call, and see what you really do employ yourself in. I hope you will. Then you will see for yourself how beautiful Hellstone is. Now I must go. Edith is sitting down to play, and I just know enough of music to turn over the leaves for her, and besides, Aunt Shaw won't like us to talk. Edith played brilliantly. In the middle of the piece the door half opened, and Edith saw Captain Lennox hesitating whether to come in. She threw down her music, and rushed out of the room, leaving Margaret standing confused and blushing to explain to the astonished guests what vision had shown itself to cause Edith's sudden flight. Captain Lennox had come earlier than was expected, or was it really so late? They looked at their watches, were duly shocked, and took their leave. Then Edith came back, glowing with pleasure, half shyly, half proudly, leading in her tall handsome captain. His brother shook hands with him, and Mrs. Shaw welcomed him in her gentle kindly way, which had always something plaintive in it, arising from the long habit of considering herself a victim to an uncongenial marriage. Now that, the general being gone, she had every good of life, with as few drawbacks as possible, she had been rather perplexed to find an anxiety, if not a sorrow. She had, however, of late settled upon her own health as a source of apprehension. She had a nervous little cough whenever she thought about it, and some complacent doctor ordered her just what she desired, a winter in Italy. Mrs. Shaw had as strong wishes as most people, but she never liked to do anything from the open and acknowledged motive of her own goodwill and pleasure. She preferred being compelled to gratify herself by some other person's command or desire. She really did persuade herself that she was submitting to some hard external necessity, and thus she was able to moan and complain in her soft manner, all the time she was in reality doing just what she liked. It was in this way she began to speak of her own journey to Captain Lennox, who assented, as in duty bound, to all his future mother-in-law said, while his eyes sought Edith, who was busying herself in rearranging the tea table, and ordering up all sorts of good things, in spite of his assurances that he had dined within the last 2 hours. Mr. Henry Lennox stood leaning against the chimney-piece, amused with the family scene. He was close by his handsome brother. He was the plain one in a singularly good-looking family, but his face was intelligent, keen, and mobile, And now and then Margaret wondered what it was that he could be thinking about, while he kept silence, but was evidently observing, with an interest that was slightly sarcastic, all that Edith and she were doing. The sarcastic feeling was called out by Mrs. Shaw's conversation with his brother. It was separate from the interest which was excited by what he saw. He thought it a pretty sight to see the two cousins so busy in their little arrangements about the table. Edith chose to do most herself. She was in a humor to enjoy showing her lover how well she could behave as a soldier's wife. She found out that the water in the urn was cold, and ordered up the great kitchen tea kettle, the only consequence of which was that when she met it at the door, and tried to carry it in, it was too heavy for her, and she came in pouting, with a black mark on her muslin gown, and a little round white hand indented by the handle, which she took to show to Captain Lennox, just like a hurt child, and, of course, the remedy was the same in both cases. Margaret's quickly adjusted spirit lamp was the most efficacious contrivance, though not so like the gypsy encampment which Edith, in some of her moods, chose to consider the nearest resemblance to a barrack life. After this evening all was bustle till the wedding was over. Chapter 2. Roses and Thorns. By the soft green light in the woody glade, on the banks of moss where thy childhood played, by the household tree, through which thine eye first looked in love to the summer sky. Mrs. Hemans. Margaret was once more in her morning dress, traveling quietly home with her father, who had come up to assist at the wedding. Her mother had been detained at home by a multitude of half-reasons, none of which anybody fully understood, except Mr. Hale, who was perfectly aware that all his arguments in favor of a gray satin gown, which was midway between oldness and newness, had proved unavailing, and that, as he had not the money to equip his wife afresh, from top to toe, she would not show herself at her only sister's only child's wedding. If Mrs. Shaw had guessed at the real reason why Mrs. Hale did not accompany her husband, she would have showered down gowns upon her, but it was nearly 20 years since Mrs. Shaw had been the poor, pretty Miss Beresford, and she had really forgotten all grievances except that of the unhappiness arising from disparity of age in married life, on which she could descant by the half hour. Dearest Maria had married the man of her heart, only 8 years older than herself, with the sweetest temper, and that blue-black hair one so seldom sees. Mr. Hale was one of the most delightful preachers she had ever heard, and a perfect model of a parish priest. Perhaps it was not quite a logical deduction from all these premises, but it was still Mrs. Shaw's characteristic conclusion, as she thought over her sister's lot, married for love, what can dearest Maria have to wish for in this world? Mrs. Hale, if she spoke truth, might have answered with a ready-made list, a silver-gray glossy silk, a white chip bonnet, oh, dozens of things for the wedding, and hundreds of things for the house. Margaret only knew that her mother had not found it convenient to come, and she was not sorry to think that their meeting and greeting would take place at Helstone Parsonage, rather than, during the confusion of the last 2 or 3 days, in the house in Harley Street, where she herself had had to play the part of Figaro, and was wanted everywhere at one and the same time. Her mind and body ached now with the recollection of all she had done and said within the last 48 hours. The farewells so hurriedly taken, amongst all the other goodbyes, of those she had lived with so long, oppressed her now with a sad regret for the times that were no more. It did not signify what those times had been, they were gone never to return. Margaret's heart felt more heavy than she could ever have thought it possible in going to her own dear home, the place and the life she had longed for years at that time of all times for yearning and longing, just before the sharp senses lose their outlines in sleep. She took her mind away with a wrench from the recollection of the past to the bright serene contemplation of the hopeful future. Her eyes began to see, not visions of what had been, but the sight actually before her, her dear father leaning back asleep in the railway carriage. His blue-black hair was gray now, and lay thinly over his brows. The bones of his face were plainly to be seen, too plainly for beauty. If his features had been less finely cut, as it was, they had a grace if not a comeliness of their own. The face was in repose, but it was rather rest after weariness, than the serene calm of the countenance of one who led a placid, contented life. Margaret was painfully struck by the worn, anxious expression, and she went back over the open and avowed circumstances of her father's life, to find the cause for the lines that spoke so plainly of habitual distress and depression. Poor Frederick! Thought she, sighing. Oh! If Frederick had but been a clergyman, instead of going into the Navy, and being lost to us all. I wish I knew all about it. I never understood it from Aunt Shaw, I only knew he could not come back to England because of that terrible affair. Poor dear Papa! How sad he looks! I'm so glad I am going home, to be at hand to comfort him and Mama. She was ready with a bright smile, in which there was not a trace of fatigue, to greet her father when he awakened. He smiled back again, but faintly, as if it were an unusual exertion. His face returned into its lines of habitual anxiety. He had a trick of half-opening his mouth as if to speak, which constantly unsettled the form of the lips, and gave the face an undecided expression. But he had the same large, soft eyes as his daughter, eyes which moved slowly and almost grandly round in their orbits, and were well veiled by their transparent white eyelids. Margaret was more like him than like her mother. Sometimes people wondered that parents so handsome should have a daughter who was so far from regularly beautiful, not beautiful at all, was occasionally said. Her mouth was wide, no rosebud that could only open just enough to let out a yes and no, and an't please you, sir. But the wide mouth was, one soft curve of rich red lips, and the skin, if not white and fair, was of an ivory smoothness and delicacy. If the look on her face was, in general, too dignified and reserved for one so young, now, talking to her father, it was bright as the morning, full of dimples, and glances that spoke of childish gladness, and boundless hope in the future. It was the latter part of July when Margaret returned home. The forest trees were all one dark, full, dusky green, the fern below them caught all the slanting sunbeams, the weather was sultry and broodingly still. Margaret used to tramp along by her father's side, crushing down the fern with a cruel glee, as she felt it yield under her light foot, and send up the fragrance peculiar to it, out on the broad commons into the warm scented light, seeing multitudes of wild, free, living creatures, reveling in the sunshine, and the herbs and flowers it called forth. This life, at least these walks, realized all Margaret's anticipations. She took a pride in her forest. Its people were her people. She made hearty friends with them, learned and delighted in using their peculiar words, took up her freedom amongst them, nursed their babies, talked or read with slow distinctness to their old people, carried dainty messes to their sick, resolved before long to teach at the school, where her father went every day as to an appointed task, but she was continually tempted off to go and see some individual friend, man, woman, or child in some cottage in the green shade of the forest. Her out-of-doors life was perfect. Her indoors life had its drawbacks. With the healthy shame of a child, she blamed herself for her keenness of sight, in perceiving that all was not as it should be there. Her mother always so kind and tender towards her seemed now and then so much discontented with their situation, thought that the bishop strangely neglected his episcopal duties, in not giving Mr. Hale a better living, and almost reproached her husband because he could not bring himself to say that he wished to leave the parish, and undertake the charge of a larger. He would sigh aloud as he answered, that if he could do what he ought in Little Helstone, he should be thankful, but every day he was more overpowered, the world became more bewildering. At each repeated urgency of his wife, that he would put himself in the way of seeking some preferment, Margaret saw that her father shrank more and more, and she strove at such times to reconcile her mother to Helstone. Mrs. Hale said that the near neighborhood of so many trees affected her health, and Margaret would try to tempt her forth onto the beautiful, broad, upland, sun-streaked, cloud-shadowed common, for she was sure that her mother had accustomed herself too much to an indoors life, seldom extending her walks beyond the church, the school, and the neighboring cottages. This did good for a time, but when the autumn drew on, and the weather became more changeable, her mother's idea of the unhealthiness of the place increased, and she repined even more frequently that her husband, who was more learned than Mr. Hume, a better parish priest than Mr. Holdsworth, should not have met with the preferment that these two former neighbors of theirs had done. This marring of the peace of home, by long hours of discontent, was what Margaret was unprepared for. She knew, and had rather reveled in the idea, that she should have to give up many luxuries, which had only been troubles and trammels to her freedom in Harley Street. Her keen enjoyment of every sensuous pleasure, was balanced finally, if not overbalanced, by her conscious pride in being able to do without them all, if need were. But the cloud never comes in that quarter of the horizon from which we watch for it. There had been slight complaints and passing regrets on her mother's part, over some trifle connected with Helstone, and her father's position there, when Margaret had been spending her holidays at home before, but in the general happiness of the recollection of those times, she had forgotten the small details which were not so pleasant. In the latter half of September, the autumnal rains and storms came on, and Margaret was obliged to remain more in the house than she had hitherto done. Helstone was at some distance from any neighbors of their own standard of cultivation. "It is undoubtedly one of the most out-of-the-way places in England," said Mrs. Hale, in one of her plaintive moods. "I can't help regretting constantly that Papa has really no one to associate with here, he is so thrown away, seeing no one but farmers and laborers from week's end to week's end. If we only lived at the other side of the parish, it would be something. There we should be almost within walking distance of the Stansfields, certainly the Gormans would be within a walk. Gormans, said Margaret. Are those the Gormans who made their fortunes in trade at Southampton? Oh. I'm glad we don't visit them. I don't like shoppy people. I think we are far better off, knowing only cottagers and laborers, and people without pretense. You must not be so fastidious, Margaret, dear, said her mother, secretly thinking of a young and handsome Mr. Gorman whom she had once met at Mr. Hume's. No. I call mine a very comprehensive taste. I like all people whose occupations have to do with land, I like soldiers and sailors, and the three learned professions, as they call them. I'm sure you don't want me to admire butchers and bakers, and candlestick makers, do you, Mama? But the Gormans were neither butchers nor bakers, but very respectable coach builders. Very well. Coach building is a trade all the same, and I think a much more useless one than that of butchers or bakers. Oh! How tired I used to be of the drives every day in Aunt Shaw's carriage, and how I longed to walk. And walk Margaret did, in spite of the weather. She was so happy out of doors, at her father's side, that she almost danced, and with the soft violence of the west wind behind her, as she crossed some heath, she seemed to be borne onwards, as lightly and easily as the fallen leaf that was wafted along by the autumnal breeze. But the evenings were rather difficult to fill up agreeably. Immediately after tea her father withdrew into his small library, and she and her mother were left alone. Mrs. Hale had never cared much for books, and had discouraged her husband, very early in their married life, in his desire of reading aloud to her, while she worked. At one time they had tried backgammon as a resource, but as Mr. Hale grew to take an increasing interest in his school and his parishioners, he found that the interruptions which arose out of these duties were regarded as hardships by his wife, not to be accepted as the natural conditions of his profession, but to be regretted and struggled against by her as they severally arose. So he withdrew, while the children were yet young, into his library, to spend his evenings, if he were at home, in reading the speculative and metaphysical books which were his delight. When Margaret had been here before, she had brought down with her a great box of books, recommended by masters or governess, and had found the summer's day all too short to get through the reading she had to do before her return to town. Now there were only the well-bound little red English classics, which were weeded out of her father's library to fill up the small bookshelves in the drawing room. Thomson's Seasons, Haley's Cooper, Middleton's Cicero, were by far the lightest, newest, and most amusing. The bookshelves did not afford much resource. Margaret told her mother every particular of her London life, to all of which Mrs. Hale listened with interest, sometimes amused and questioning, at others a little inclined to compare her sister's circumstances of ease and comfort with the narrower means at Helstone Vicarage. On such evenings Margaret was apt to stop talking rather abruptly, and listen to the drip-drip of the rain upon the leads of the little bow window. Once or twice Margaret found herself mechanically counting the repetition of the monotonous sound, while she wondered if she might venture to put a question on a subject very near to her heart, and ask where Frederick was now, what he was doing, how long it was since they had heard from him. But a consciousness that her mother's delicate health, and positive dislike to Helstone, all dated from the time of the mutiny in which Frederick had been engaged, the full account of which Margaret had never heard, and which now seemed doomed to be buried in sad oblivion, made her pause and turn away from the subject each time she approached it. When she was with her mother, her father seemed the best person to apply to for information, and when with him, she thought that she could speak more easily to her mother. Probably there was nothing much to be heard that was new. In one of the letters she had received before leaving Harley Street, her father had told her that they had heard from Frederick, he was still at Rio, and very well in health, and sent his best love to her, which was dry bones, but not the living intelligence she longed for. Frederick was always spoken of, in the rare times when his name was mentioned, as poor Frederick. His room was kept exactly as he had left it, and was regularly dusted, and put into order by Dixon, Mrs. Hale's maid, who touched no other part of the household work, but always remembered the day when she had been engaged by Lady Beresford as lady's maid to Sir John's wards, the pretty Miss Beresfords, the belles of Rutlandshire. Dixon had always considered Mr. Hale as the blight which had fallen upon her young lady's prospects in life. If Miss Beresford had not been in such a hurry to marry a poor country clergyman, there was no knowing what she might not have become. But Dixon was too loyal to desert her in her affliction and downfall, alias her married life. She remained with her, and was devoted to her interests, Always considering herself as the good and protecting fairy, whose duty it was to baffle the malignant giant, Mr. Hale. Master Frederick had been her favorite and pride, and it was with a little softening of her dignified look and manner, that she went in weakly to arrange the chamber as carefully as if he might be coming home that very evening. Margaret could not help believing that there had been some late intelligence of Frederick, unknown to her mother, which was making her father anxious and uneasy. Mrs. Hale did not seem to perceive any alteration in her husband's looks or ways. His spirits were always tender and gentle, readily affected by any small piece of intelligence concerning the welfare of others. He would be depressed for many days after witnessing a deathbed, or hearing of any crime. But now Margaret noticed an absence of mind, as if his thoughts were preoccupied by some subject, the oppression of which could not be relieved by any daily action, such as comforting the survivors, or teaching at the school in hope of lessening the evils in the generation to come. Mr. Hale did not go out among his parishioners as much as usual. He was more shut up in his study, was anxious for the village postman, whose summons to the household was a rap on the back kitchen window shutter, a signal which at one time had often to be repeated before anyone was sufficiently alive to the hour of the day to understand what it was, and attend to him. Now Mr. Hale loitered about the garden if the morning was fine, and if not, stood dreamily by the study window until the postman had called, or gone down the lane, giving a half-respectful, half-confidential shake of the head to the parson, who watched him away beyond the sweetbriar hedge, and past the great arbutus, before he turned into the room to begin his day's work, with all the signs of a heavy heart and an occupied mind. But Margaret was at an age when any apprehension, not absolutely based on a knowledge of facts, is easily banished for a time by a bright sunny day, or some happy outward circumstance. And when the brilliant 14 fine days of October came on, her cares were all blown away as lightly as thistledown, and she thought of nothing but the glories of the forest. The fern harvest was over, and now that the rain was gone, many a deep glade was accessible, into which Margaret had only peeped in July and August weather. She had learnt drawing with Edith, and she had sufficiently regretted, during the gloom of the bad weather, her idle reveling in the beauty of the woodlands while it had yet been fine, to make her determined to sketch what she could before winter fairly set in. Accordingly, she was busy preparing her board one morning, when Sarah, the housemaid, threw wide open the drawing-room door and announced, "Mr. Henry Lennox." Chapter 3. The more haste the worse speed. Learn to win a lady's faith nobly, as the thing is high, bravely, as for life and death with a loyal gravity. Lead her from the festive boards, point her to the starry skies, guard her, by your truthful words, pure from courtship's flatteries. Mrs. Browning. Mr. Henry Lennox. Margaret had been thinking of him only a moment before, and remembering his inquiry into her probable occupations at home. It was parlour du soleil et lawn en voit les rayons, and the brightness of the sun came over Margaret's face as she put down her board, and went forward to shake hands with him. "Tell Mama, Sarah," said she. "Mama and I want to ask you so many questions about Edith. I am so much obliged to you for coming." "Did not I say that I should?" asked he, in a lower tone than that in which she had spoken. "But I heard of you so far away in the Highlands that I never thought Hampshire could come in." "Oh," said he, more lightly, "our young couple were playing such foolish pranks, running all sorts of risks, climbing this mountain, sailing on that lake, that I really thought they needed a mentor to take care of them. And indeed they did. They were quite beyond my uncle's management, and kept the old gentleman in a panic for 16 hours out of the 24. Indeed, when I once saw how unfit they were to be trusted alone, I thought it my duty not to leave them till I had seen them safely embarked at Plymouth."
"Have you been at Plymouth?"
"Oh, Edith never named that. To be sure, she has written in such a hurry lately. Did they really sail on Tuesday?"
"Really sailed, and relieved me from many responsibilities. Edith gave me all sorts of messages for you. I believe I have a little diminutive note somewhere."
"Yes, here it is."
"Oh, thank you," exclaimed Margaret, and then, half wishing to read it alone and unwatched, she made the excuse of going to tell her mother again. Sarah surely had made some mistake, that Mr. Lennox was there. When she had left the room, he began in his scrutinizing way to look about him. The little drawing room was looking its best in the streaming light of the morning sun. The middle window in the bow was opened, and clustering roses and the scarlet honeysuckle came peeping round the corner. The small lawn was gorgeous with verbenas and geraniums of all bright colors. But the very brightness outside made the colors within seem poor and faded. The carpet was far from new, the chintz had been often washed, the whole apartment was smaller and shabbier than he had expected, as background and framework for Margaret, herself so queenly. He took up one of the books lying on the table. It was the Paradiso of Dante, in the proper old Italian binding of white vellum and gold. By it lay a dictionary, and some words copied out in Margaret's handwriting. They were a dull list of words, but somehow he liked looking at them. He put them down with a sigh. "The living is evidently as small as," she said. "It seems strange, for the Beresfords belong to a good family." Margaret meanwhile had found her mother. It was one of Mrs. Hale's fitful days, when everything was a difficulty and a hardship, and Mr. Lennox's appearance took this shape, although secretly she felt complimented by his thinking it worthwhile to call. "It is most unfortunate. We are dining early today, and having nothing but cold meat, in order that the servants may get on with their ironing, and yet, of course, we must ask him to dinner, Edith's brother-in-law and all. And your papa is in such low spirits this morning about something I don't know what. I went into the study just now, and he had his face on the table, covering it with his hands. I told him I was sure Helstone Air did not agree with him any more than with me, and he suddenly lifted up his head, and begged me not to speak a word more against Helstone. He could not bear it. If there was one place he loved on earth, it was Helstone. But I am sure, for all that, it is the damp and relaxing air." Margaret felt as if a thin cold cloud had come between her and the sun. She had listened patiently, in hopes that it might be some relief to her mother to unburden herself, but now it was time to draw her back to Mr. Lennox. "Papa likes Mr. Lennox. They got on together famously at the wedding breakfast. I dare say his coming will do Papa good. And never mind the dinner, dear Mama. Cold meat will do capitally for a lunch, which is the light in which Mr. Lennox will most likely look upon a 2 o'clock dinner. But what are we to do with him till then? It is only 10:30 now. I'll ask him to go out sketching with me. I know he draws, and that will take him out of your way, Mama. Only do come in now, he will think it so strange if you don't." Mrs. Hale took off her black silk apron, and smoothed her face. She looked a very pretty ladylike woman, as she greeted Mr. Lennox with the cordiality due to one who was almost a relation. He evidently expected to be asked to spend the day, and accepted the invitation with a glad readiness that made Mrs. Hale wish she could add something to the cold beef. He was pleased with everything, delighted with Margaret's idea of going out sketching together, would not have Mr. Hale disturbed for the world, with the prospect of so soon meeting him at dinner. Margaret brought out her drawing materials for him to choose from, and after the paper and brushes had been duly selected, the two set out in the merriest spirits in the world. "Now, please, just stop here for a minute or two," said Margaret. "These are the cottages that haunted me so during the rainy fortnight, reproaching me for not having sketched them before they tumbled down and were no more seen. Truly, if they are to be sketched and they are very picturesque, we had better not put it off till next year. But where shall we sit? Oh, you might have come straight from chambers in the temple, instead of having been 2 months in the highlands. Look at this beautiful trunk of a tree, which the woodcutters have left just in the right place for the light. I will put my plaid over it, and it will be a regular forest throne. With your feet in that puddle for a regal footstool. Stay, I will move, and then you can come nearer this way. Who lives in these cottages?" They were built by squatters 50 or 60 years ago. One is uninhabited, the foresters are going to take it down, as soon as the old man who lives in the other is dead, poor old fellow. Look, there he is, I must go and speak to him. He is so deaf you will hear all our secrets." The old man stood bareheaded in the sun, leaning on his stick at the front of his cottage. His stiff features relaxed into a slow smile as Margaret went up and spoke to him. Mr. Lennox hastily introduced the two figures into his sketch, and finished up the landscape with a subordinate reference to them as Margaret perceived, when the time came for getting up, putting away water, and scraps of paper, and exhibiting to each other their sketches. She laughed and blushed. Mr. Lennox watched her countenance. "Now, I call that treacherous," said she. "I little thought you were making old Isaac and me into subjects, when you told me to ask him the history of these cottages. It was irresistible. You can't know how strong a temptation it was. I hardly dare tell you how much I shall like this sketch." He was not quite sure whether she heard this latter sentence before she went to the brook to wash her palette. She came back rather flushed, but looking perfectly innocent and unconscious. He was glad of it, for the speech had slipped from him unawares, a rare thing in the case of a man who premeditated his actions so much as Henry Lennox. The aspect of home was all right and bright when they reached it. The clouds on her mother's brow had cleared off under the propitious influence of a brace of carp, most opportunely presented by a neighbor. Mr. Hale had returned from his morning's round, and was awaiting his visitor just outside the wicket gate that led into the garden. He looked a complete gentleman in his rather threadbare coat and well-worn hat. Margaret was proud of her father. She had always a fresh and tender pride in seeing how favorably he impressed every stranger. Still, her quick eye sought over his face and found there traces of some unusual disturbance, which was only put aside, not cleared away. Mr. Hale asked to look at their sketches. "I think you have made the tints on the thatch too dark, have you not?" As he returned Margaret's to her, and held out his hand for Mr. Lennox's, which was withheld from him one moment, no more. "No, Papa. I don't think I have. The house leek and stonecrop have grown so much darker in the rain. Is it not like, Papa?" said she, peeping over his shoulder, as he looked at the figures in Mr. Lennox's drawing. "Yes, very like. Your figure and way of holding yourself is capital. And it is just poor old Isaac's stiff way of stooping his long rheumatic back. What is this hanging from the branch of the tree? Not a bird's nest, surely. Oh no. That is my bonnet. I never can draw with my bonnet on, it makes my head so hot. I wonder if I could manage figures. There are so many people about here whom I should like to sketch." "I should say that a likeness you very much wish to take you would always succeed in," said Mr. Lennox. "I have great faith in the power of will. I think myself I have succeeded pretty well in yours." Mr. Hale had preceded them into the house, while Margaret was lingering to pluck some roses, with which to adorn her morning gown for dinner. "A regular London girl would understand the implied meaning of that speech," thought Mr. Lennox. "She would be up to looking through every speech that a young man made her for the arrière-pensée of a compliment. But I don't believe Margaret, stay," exclaimed he, "let me help you," and he gathered for her some velvety cramoisy roses that were above her reach, and then dividing the spoil he placed two in his buttonhole, and sent her in, pleased and happy, to arrange her flowers. The conversation at dinner flowed on quietly and agreeably. There were plenty of questions to be asked on both sides, the latest intelligence which each could give of Mrs. Shaw's movements in Italy to be exchanged, and in the interest of what was said, the unpretending simplicity of the parsonage ways above all, in the neighborhood of Margaret, Mr. Lennox forgot the little feeling of disappointment with which he had at first perceived that she had spoken but the simple truth when she had described her father's living as very small. "Margaret, my child, you might have gathered us some pears for our dessert," said Mr. Hale, as the hospitable luxury of a freshly decanted bottle of wine was placed on the table. Mrs. Hale was hurried. It seemed as if desserts were impromptu and unusual things at the parsonage, whereas, if Mr. Hale would only have looked behind him, he would have seen biscuits and marmalade, and what not, all arranged in formal order on the sideboard. But the idea of pears had taken possession of Mr. Hale's mind, and was not to be got rid of. "There are a few brown beer against the south wall which are worth all foreign fruits and preserves. Run, Margaret, and gather us some. I propose that we adjourn into the garden, and eat them there," said Mr. Lennox. "Nothing is so delicious as to set one's teeth into the crisp, juicy fruit, warm and scented by the sun. The worst is, the wasps are impudent enough to dispute it with one, even at the very crisis and summit of enjoyment." He rose, as if to follow Margaret, who had disappeared through the window. He only awaited Mrs. Hale's permission. She would rather have wound up the dinner in the proper way, and with all the ceremonies which had gone on so smoothly hitherto, especially as she and Dixon had got out the finger glasses from the storeroom on purpose to be as correct as became General Shaw's widow's sister, but as Mr. Hale got up directly, and prepared to accompany his guest, she could only submit. "I shall arm myself with a knife," said Mr. Hale, "the days of eating fruit so primitively as you describe are over with me. I must pare it and quarter it before I can enjoy it." Margaret made a plate for the pears out of a beetroot leaf, which threw up their brown gold color admirably. Mr. Lennox looked more at her than at the pears, but her father, inclined to cull fastidiously the very zest and perfection of the hour he had stolen from his anxiety, chose daintily the ripest fruit, and sat down on the garden bench to enjoy it at his leisure. Margaret and Mr. Lennox strolled along the little terrace walk under the south wall, where the bees still hummed and worked busily in their hives. "What a perfect life you seem to live here. I have always felt rather contemptuously towards the poets before, with their wishes, mine be a cot beside a hill, and that sort of thing, but now I am afraid that the truth is, I have been nothing better than a cockney. Just now I feel as if 20 years' hard study of law would be amply rewarded by 1 year of such an exquisite serene life as this, such skies. Looking up such crimson and amber foliage, so perfectly motionless as that," pointing to some of the great forest trees which shut in the garden as if it were a nest. You must please to remember that our skies are not always as deep a blue as they are now. We have rain, and our leaves do fall, and get sodden, though I think Halstone is about as perfect a place as any in the world. Recollect how you rather scorned my description of it one evening in Harley Street, a village in a tale.
Scorned, Margaret. That is rather a hard word.
Perhaps it is. Only I know I should have liked to have talked to you of what I was very full at the time, and you what must I call it, then? Spoke disrespectfully of Halstone as a mere village in a tale.
I will never do so again, said he, warmly. They turned the corner of the walk.
I could almost wish, Margaret, he stopped and hesitated. It was so unusual for the fluent lawyer to hesitate that Margaret looked up at him, in a little state of questioning wonder, but in an instant from what about him she could not tell she wished herself back with her mother her father anywhere away from him, for she was sure he was going to say something to which she should not know what to reply. In another moment the strong pride that was in her came to conquer her sudden agitation, which she hoped he had not perceived. Of course she could answer, and answer the right thing, and it was poor and despicable of her to shrink from hearing any speech, as if she had not power to put an end to it with her high maidenly dignity.
Margaret, said he, taking her by surprise, and getting sudden possession of her hand, so that she was forced to stand still and listen, despising herself for the fluttering at her heart all the time, Margaret, I wish you did not like Halstone so much, did not seem so perfectly calm and happy here. I have been hoping for these 3 months past to find you regretting London and London friends, a little enough to make you listen more kindly, for she was quietly, but firmly, striving to extricate her hand from his grasp, to one who has not much to offer, it is true nothing but prospects in the future but who does love you, Margaret, almost in spite of himself.
Margaret, have I startled you too much?
Speak.
For he saw her lips quivering almost as if she were going to cry. She made a strong effort to be calm. She would not speak till she had succeeded in mastering her voice, and then she said.
I was startled. I did not know that you cared for me in that way. I have always thought of you as a friend, and, please, I would rather go on thinking of you so. I don't like to be spoken to as you have been doing. I cannot answer you as you want me to do, and yet I should feel so sorry if I vexed you.
Margaret, said he, looking into her eyes, which met his with their open, straight look, expressive of the utmost good faith and reluctance to give pain. Do you he was going to say love anyone else? But it seemed as if this question would be an insult to the pure serenity of those eyes.
Forgive me, I have been too abrupt. I am punished. Only let me hope.
Give me the poor comfort of telling me you have never seen anyone whom you could, again a pause.
He could not end his sentence.
Margaret reproached herself acutely as the cause of his distress.
Ah! If you had but never got this fancy into your head. It was such a pleasure to think of you as a friend.
But I may hope, may I not, Margaret, that sometime you will think of me as a lover?
Not yet, I see there is no hurry but sometime, she was silent for a minute or two, trying to discover the truth as it was in her own heart, before replying, then she said.
I have never thought of you, but as a friend. I like to think of you so, but I am sure I could never think of you as anything else.
Pray, let us both forget that all this, disagreeable, she was going to say, but stopped short, conversation has taken place.
He paused before he replied. Then, in his habitual coldness of tone, he answered.
Of course, as your feelings are so decided, and as this conversation has been so evidently unpleasant to you, it had better not be remembered. That is all very fine in theory, that plan of forgetting whatever is painful, but it will be somewhat difficult for me, at least, to carry it into execution.
You are vexed, said she, sadly, yet how can I help it? She looked so truly grieved as she said this, that he struggled for a moment with his real disappointment, and then answered more cheerfully, but still with a little hardness in his tone.
You should make allowances for the mortification, not only of a lover, Margaret, but of a man not given to romance in general, prudent, worldly, as some people call me, who has been carried out of his usual habits by the force of a passion. Well, we will say no more of that. But in the one outlet which he has formed for the deeper and better feelings of his nature, he meets with rejection and repulse. I shall have to console myself with scorning my own folly. A struggling barrister to think of matrimony.
Margaret could not answer this. The whole tone of it annoyed her. It seemed to touch on and call out all the points of difference which had often repelled her in him, while yet he was the pleasantest man, the most sympathizing friend, the person of all others who understood her best in Harley Street. She felt a tinge of contempt mingle itself with her pain at having refused him. Her beautiful lip curled in a slight disdain. It was well that, having made the round of the garden, they came suddenly upon Mr. Hale, whose whereabouts had been quite forgotten by them. He had not yet finished the pear, which he had delicately peeled in one long strip of silver paper thinness, and which he was enjoying in a deliberate manner. It was like the story of the Eastern King, who dipped his head into a basin of water, at the magician's command, and ere he instantly took it out went through the experience of a lifetime. Margaret felt stunned, and unable to recover her self-possession enough to join in the trivial conversation that ensued between her father and Mr. Lennox. She was grave, and little disposed to speak, full of wonder when Mr. Lennox would go, and allow her to relax into thought on the events of the last quarter of an hour. He was almost as anxious to take his departure as she was for him to leave, but a few minutes' light and careless talking, carried on at whatever effort, was a sacrifice which he owed to his mortified vanity, or his self-respect. He glanced from time to time at her sad and pensive face. "I am not so indifferent to her as she believes," thought he to himself. "I do not give up hope." Before a quarter of an hour was over, he had fallen into a way of conversing with quiet sarcasm, speaking of life in London and life in the country, as if he were conscious of his second mocking self, and afraid of his own satire. Mr. Hale was puzzled. His visitor was a different man to what he had seen him before at the wedding breakfast, and at dinner today, a lighter, cleverer, more worldly man, and, as such, dissonant to Mr. Hale. It was a relief to all three when Mr. Lennox said that he must go directly if he meant to catch the 5 o'clock train. They proceeded to the house to find Mrs. Hale, and wish her goodbye. At the last moment, Henry Lennox's real self broke through the crust. "Margaret, don't despise me, I have a heart, notwithstanding all this good-for-nothing way of talking. As a proof of it, I believe I love you more than ever if I do not hate you for the disdain with which you have listened to me during this last half hour. Goodbye, Margaret, Margaret." Chapter 4. Doubts and Difficulties. "Cast me upon some naked shore, where I may track only the print of some sad wrack, if thou be there, though the seas roar, I shall no gentler calm implore." Habington. He was gone. The house was shut up for the evening. No more deep blue skies or crimson and amber tints. Margaret went up to dress for the early tea, finding Dixon in a pretty temper from the interruption which a visitor had naturally occasioned on a busy day. She showed it by brushing away viciously at Margaret's hair, under pretense of being in a great hurry to go to Mrs. Hale. Yet, after all, Margaret had to wait a long time in the drawing room before her mother came down. She sat by herself at the fire, with unlighted candles on the table behind her, thinking over the day, the happy walk, happy sketching, cheerful pleasant dinner, and the uncomfortable, miserable walk in the garden. How different men were to women! Here was she disturbed and unhappy, because her instinct had made anything but a refusal impossible, while he, not many minutes after he had met with a rejection of what ought to have been the deepest, holiest proposal of his life, could speak as if briefs, success, and all its superficial consequences of a good house, clever and agreeable society, were the sole avowed objects of his desires. Oh dear! How she could have loved him if he had but been different, with a difference which she felt, on reflection, to be one that went low deep down. Then she took it into her head that, after all, his lightness might be but assumed, to cover a bitterness of disappointment which would have been stamped on her own heart if she had loved and been rejected. Her mother came into the room before this whirl of thoughts was adjusted into anything like order. Margaret had to shake off the recollections of what had been done and said through the day, and turn a sympathizing listener to the account of how Dixon had complained that the ironing blanket had been burned again, and how Susan Lightfoot had been seen with artificial flowers in her bonnet, thereby giving evidence of a vain and giddy character. Mr. Hale sipped his tea in abstracted silence. Margaret had the responses all to herself. She wondered how her father and mother could be so forgetful, so regardless of their companion through the day, as never to mention his name. She forgot that he had not made them an offer. After tea Mr. Hale got up, and stood with his elbow on the chimney-piece, leaning his head on his hand, musing over something, and from time to time sighing deeply. Mrs. Hale went out to consult with Dixon about some winter clothing for the poor. Margaret was preparing her mother's worsted work, and rather shrinking from the thought of the long evening, and wishing bedtime were come that she might go over the events of the day again. "Margaret," said Mr. Hale, at last, in a sort of sudden desperate way, that made her start. "Is that tapestry thing of immediate consequence? I mean, can you leave it and come into my study? I want to speak to you about something very serious to us all." Very serious to us all. Mr. Lennox had never had the opportunity of having any private conversation with her father after her refusal, or else that would indeed be a very serious affair. In the first place, Margaret felt guilty and ashamed of having grown so much into a woman as to be thought of in marriage, and secondly, she did not know if her father might not be displeased that she had taken upon herself to decline Mr. Lennox's proposal. But she soon felt it was not about anything, which having only lately and suddenly occurred, could have given rise to any complicated thoughts, that her father wished to speak to her. He made her take a chair by him, he stirred the fire, snuffed the candles, and sighed once or twice before he could make up his mind to say, and it came out with a jerk, "After all, Margaret, I am going to leave Helstone."
"Leave Helstone, Papa? But why?"
Mr. Hale did not answer for a minute or two. He played with some papers on the table in a nervous and confused manner, opening his lips to speak several times, but closing them again without having the courage to utter a word. Margaret could not bear the sight of a suspense, which was even more distressing to her father than to herself.
"But why, dear Papa? Do tell me."
He looked up at her suddenly, and then said with a slow and enforced calmness, "Because I must no longer be a minister in the Church of England." Margaret had imagined nothing less than that some of the preferments which her mother so much desired had befallen her father at last, something that would force him to leave beautiful, beloved Helstone, and perhaps compel him to go and live in some of the stately and silent closes which Margaret had seen from time to time in cathedral towns. They were grand and imposing places, but if, to go there, it was necessary to leave Helstone as a home forever, that would have been a sad, long, lingering pain. But nothing to the shock she received from Mr. Hale's last speech. What could he mean? It was all the worse for being so mysterious. The aspect of piteous distress on his face, almost as imploring a merciful and kind judgment from his child, gave her a sudden sickening. Could he have become implicated in anything Frederick had done? Frederick was an outlaw. Had her father, out of a natural love for his son, connived at any?
"Oh! What is it? Do speak, Papa. Tell me all. Why can you no longer be a clergyman? Surely, if the bishop were told all we know about Frederick, and the hard, unjust—"
"It is nothing about Frederick, the bishop would have nothing to do with that. It is all myself. Margaret, I will tell you about it. I will answer any questions this once, but after tonight let us never speak of it again. I can meet the consequences of my painful, miserable doubts, but it is an effort beyond me to speak of what has caused me so much suffering."
"Doubts, Papa? Doubts as to religion?" asked Margaret, more shocked than ever.
"No. Not doubts as to religion, not the slightest injury to that." He paused. Margaret sighed, as if standing on the verge of some new horror. He began again, speaking rapidly, as if to get over a set task. "You could not understand it all, if I told you my anxiety, for years past, to know whether I had any right to hold my living, my efforts to quench my smoldering doubts by the authority of the Church. Oh! Margaret, how I love the Holy Church from which I am to be shut out." He could not go on for a moment or two. Margaret could not tell what to say, it seemed to her as terribly mysterious as if her father were about to turn Mohammedan. "I have been reading today of the 2,000 who were ejected from their churches," continued Mr. Hale, smiling faintly, "trying to steal some of their bravery, but it is of no use, no use, I cannot help feeling it acutely."
"That, Papa, have you well considered?
Oh! It seems so terrible, so shocking," said Margaret, suddenly bursting into tears. The one staid foundation of her home, of her idea of her beloved father, seemed reeling and rocking. What could she say? What was to be done? The sight of her distress made Mr. Hale nerve himself, in order to try and comfort her. He swallowed down the dry choking sobs which had been heaving up from his heart hitherto, and going to his bookcase he took down a volume, which he had often been reading lately, and from which he thought he had derived strength to enter upon the course in which he was now embarked. "Listen, dear Margaret," said he, putting one arm round her waist. She took his hand in hers and grasped it tight, but she could not lift up her head, nor indeed could she attend to what he read, so great was her internal agitation. "This is the soliloquy of one who was once a clergyman in a country parish, like me. It was written by a Mr. Oldfield, minister of Carsington, in Derbyshire, 160 years ago, or more. His trials are over. He fought the good fight." These last two sentences he spoke low, as if to himself. Then he read aloud, "Dash. When thou canst no longer continue in thy work without dishonor to God, discredit to religion, foregoing thy integrity, wounding conscience, spoiling thy peace, and hazarding the loss of thy salvation, in a word, when the conditions upon which thou must continue, if thou wilt continue,
in thy employments are sinful, and unwarranted by the word of God, thou mayest, yea, thou must believe that God will turn thy very silence, suspension, deprivation, and laying aside, to his glory, and the advancement of the gospel's interest. When God will not use thee in one kind, yet he will in another. A soul that desires to serve and honor him shall never want opportunity to do it, nor must thou so limit the Holy One of Israel as to think he hath but one way in which he can glorify himself by thee. He can do it by thy silence as well as by thy preaching, thy laying aside as well as thy continuance in thy work. It is not pretense of doing God the greatest service, or performing the weightiest duty, that will excuse the least sin, though that sin capacitated or gave us the opportunity for doing that duty. Thou wilt have little thanks, O my soul, if, when thou art charged with corrupting God's worship, falsifying thy vows, thou pretendest a necessity for it in order to a continuance in the ministry. As he read this, and glanced at much more which he did not read, he gained resolution for himself, and felt as if he too could be brave and firm in doing what he believed to be right, but as he ceased he heard Margaret's low convulsive sob, and his courage sank down under the keen sense of suffering. "Margaret, dear," said he, drawing her closer, "think of the early martyrs, think of the thousands who have suffered." "That, father," said she, suddenly lifting up her flushed, tear-wet face, "the early martyrs suffered for the truth, while you, oh, dear, dear papa." "I suffer for conscience' sake, my child," said he, with a dignity that was only tremulous from the acute sensitiveness of his character. "I must do what my conscience bids. I have borne long with self-reproach that would have roused any mind less torpid and cowardly than mine." He shook his head as he went on. "Your poor mother's fond wish, gratified at last in the mocking way in which overfond wishes are too often fulfilled, sodden apples as they are, has brought on this crisis, for which I ought to be, and I hope I am, thankful. It is not a month since the bishop offered me another living. If I had accepted it, I should have had to make a fresh declaration of conformity to the liturgy at my institution. Margaret, I tried to do it. I tried to content myself with simply refusing the additional preferment, and stopping quietly here, strangling my conscience now, as I had strained it before. God forgive me." He rose and walked up and down the room, speaking low words of self-reproach and humiliation, of which Margaret was thankful to hear but few. At last he said, "Margaret, I return to the old sad burden, we must leave Helstone."
"Yes, I see. But when?"
"I have written to the bishop, I dare say I have told you so, but I forget things just now," said Mr. Hale, collapsing into his depressed manner as soon as he came to talk of hard matter-of-fact details, informing him of my intention to resign this vicarage. "He has been most kind, he has used arguments and expostulations, all in vain, in vain. They are but what I have tried upon myself, without avail. I shall have to take my deed of resignation, and wait upon the bishop myself, to bid him farewell. That will be a trial, but worse, far worse, will be the parting from my dear people. There is a curate appointed to read prayers, a Mr. Brown. He will come to stay with us tomorrow. Next Sunday I preach my farewell sermon." Was it to be so sudden then? Thought Margaret, and yet perhaps it was as well. Lingering would only add stings to the pain. It was better to be stunned into numbness by hearing of all these arrangements, which seemed to be nearly completed before she had been told. "What does Mama say?" asked she, with a deep sigh. To her surprise, her father began to walk about again before he answered. At length he stopped and replied, "Margaret, I am a poor coward after all. I cannot bear to give pain. I know so well your mother's married life has not been all she hoped, all she had a right to expect, and this will be such a blow to her, that I have never had the heart, the power to tell her. She must be told though, now," said he, looking wistfully at his daughter. Margaret was almost overpowered with the idea that her mother knew nothing of it all, and yet the affair was so far advanced.
"Yes, indeed she must," said Margaret. "Perhaps, after all, she may not." "Oh yes, she will. She must be shocked as the force of the blow returned upon herself in trying to realize how another would take it." "Where are we to go to?" said she at last, struck with a fresh wonder as to their future plans, if plans indeed her father had.
"To Milton Northern," he answered, with a dull indifference, for he had perceived that, although his daughter's love had made her cling to him, and for a moment strive to soothe him with her love, yet the keenness of the pain was as fresh as ever in her mind.
"Milton Northern, the manufacturing town in Darkshire?"
"Yes," said he, in the same despondent, indifferent way.
"Why there, papa?" asked she.
"Because there I can earn bread for my family. Because I know no one there,
and no one knows Hellstone, or can ever talk to me about it.
Bread for your family. I thought you and Mama had, and then she stopped, checking her natural interest regarding their future life, as she saw the gathering gloom on her father's brow. But he, with his quick intuitive sympathy, read in her face, as in a mirror, the reflections of his own moody depression, and turned it off with an effort.
You shall be told all, Margaret. Only help me to tell your mother. I think I could do anything but that. The idea of her distress turns me sick with dread. If I tell you all, perhaps you could break it to her tomorrow. I am going out for the day, to bid Farmer Dobson and the poor people on Bracy Common goodbye. Would you dislike breaking it to her very much, Margaret?
Margaret did dislike it, did shrink from it more than from anything she had ever had to do in her life before. She could not speak, all at once. Her father said, "You dislike it very much, don't you, Margaret?" Then she conquered herself, and said, with a bright strong look on her face, "It is a painful thing, but it must be done, and I will do it as well as ever I can. You must have many painful things to do." Mr. Hale shook his head despondingly. He pressed her hand in token of gratitude. Margaret was nearly upset again into a burst of crying. To turn her thoughts, she said, "Now tell me, Papa, what our plans are. You and Mama have some money, independent of the income from the living, have not you? Aunt Shaw has, I know."
"Yes. I suppose we have about £170 a year of our own. 70 of that has always gone to Frederick, since he has been abroad. I don't know if he wants it all," he continued in a hesitating manner. "He must have some pay for serving with the Spanish army."
"Frederick must not suffer," said Margaret, decidedly, "in a foreign country, so unjustly treated by his own. 100 is left. Could not you, and I, and Mama live on 100 a year in some very cheap, very quiet part of England?"
"Oh, I think we could."
"No," said Mr. Hale. "That would not answer. I must do something. I must make myself busy, to keep off morbid thoughts. Besides, in a country parish I should be so painfully reminded of Hellstone, and my duties here. I could not bear it, Margaret. And 100 a year would go a very little way, after the necessary wants of housekeeping are met, towards providing your mother with all the comforts she has been accustomed to, and ought to have. Number we must go to Milton. That is settled. I can always decide better by myself, and not influenced by those whom I love," said he, as a half apology for having arranged so much before he had told any one of his family of his intentions. "I cannot stand objections. They make me so undecided." Margaret resolved to keep silence. After all, what did it signify where they went, compared to the one terrible change? Mr. Hale continued, "A few months ago, when my misery of doubt became more than I could bear without speaking, I wrote to Mr. Bell." "You remember Mr. Bell, Margaret?"
"No, I never saw him, I think. But I know who he is. Frederick's godfather, your old tutor at Oxford, don't you mean?"
"Yes. He is a fellow of Plymouth College there. He is a native of Milton Northern, I believe. At any rate, he has property there, which has very much increased in value since Milton has become such a large manufacturing town. Well, I had reason to suspect to imagine I had better say nothing about it, however. But I felt sure of sympathy from Mr. Bell. I don't know that he gave me much strength. He has lived an easy life in his college all his days. But he has been as kind as can be. And it is owing to him we are going to Milton."
"How?" said Margaret.
"Why, he has tenants, and houses, and mills there, so, though he dislikes the place too bustling for one of his habits, he is obliged to keep up some sort of connection, and he tells me that he hears there is a good opening for a private tutor there."
"A private tutor?" said Margaret, looking scornful. "What in the world do manufacturers want with the classics, or literature, or the accomplishments of a gentleman?"
"Oh," said her father, "some of them really seem to be fine fellows, conscious of their own deficiencies, which is more than many a man at Oxford is. Some want resolutely to learn, though they have come to man's estate. Some want their children to be better instructed than they themselves have been. At any rate, there is an opening, as I have said, for a private tutor. Mr. Bell has recommended me to a Mr. Thornton, a tenant of his, and a very intelligent man, as far as I can judge from his letters. And in Milton, Margaret, I shall find a busy life, if not a happy one, and people and scenes so different that I shall never be reminded of Hellstone." There was the secret motive, as Margaret knew from her own feelings. It would be different. Discordant as it was with almost a detestation for all she had ever heard of the north of England, the manufacturers, the people,
The wild and bleak country, there was this one recommendation: it would be different from Hellstone, and could never remind them of that beloved place.
"When do we go?" asked Margaret, after a short silence.
"I do not know exactly. I wanted to talk it over with you. You see, your mother knows nothing about it yet, but I think, in a fortnight, after my deed of resignation is sent in, I shall have no right to remain."
Margaret was almost stunned.
"In a fortnight?"
"No, no, not exactly to a day. Nothing is fixed," said her father, with anxious hesitation, as he noticed the filmy sorrow that came over her eyes, and the sudden change in her complexion. But she recovered herself immediately.
"Yes, Papa, it had better be fixed soon and decidedly, as you say. Only Mama to know nothing about it. It is that is the great perplexity."
"Poor Maria," replied Mr. Hale, tenderly. "Poor, poor Maria. Oh, if I were not married, if I were but myself in the world, how easy it would be. As it is, Margaret, I dare not tell her."
"No," said Margaret, sadly, "I will do it. Give me till tomorrow evening to choose my time."
"Oh, Papa," cried she, with sudden passionate entreaty, "say, tell me it is a nightmare, a horrid dream, not the real waking truth. You cannot mean that you are really going to leave the church, to give up Hellstone, to be forever separate from me, from Mama, led away by some delusion, some temptation. You do not really mean it?"
Mr. Hale sat in rigid stillness while she spoke. Then he looked her in the face, and said in a slow, hoarse, measured way, "I do mean it, Margaret. You must not deceive yourself into doubting the reality of my words, my fixed intention and resolve." He looked at her in the same steady, stony manner, for some moments after he had done speaking. She, too, gazed back with pleading eyes before she would believe that it was irrevocable. Then she arose and went, without another word or look, towards the door. As her fingers were on the handle, he called her back. He was standing by the fireplace, shrunk and stooping, but as she came near he drew himself up to his full height, and, placing his hands on her head, he said, solemnly, "The blessing of God be upon thee, my child."
"And may he restore you to his church," responded she, out of the fullness of her heart. The next moment she feared lest this answer to his blessing might be irreverent, wrong, might hurt him as coming from his daughter, and she threw her arms round his neck. He held her to him for a minute or two. She heard him murmur to himself, "The martyrs and confessors had even more pain to bear, I will not shrink." They were startled by hearing Mrs. Hale inquiring for her daughter. They started asunder in the full consciousness of all that was before them. Mr. Hale hurriedly said, "Go, Margaret, go. I shall be at all tomorrow. Before night you will have told your mother."
"Yes," she replied, and she returned to the drawing room in a stunned and dizzy state. Chapter 5. Decision. I ask thee for a thoughtful love, through constant watching wise, to meet the glad with joyful smiles, and to wipe the weeping eyes, and a heart at leisure from itself to soothe and sympathize. Anon. Margaret made a good listener to all her mother's little plans for adding some small comforts to the lot of the poorer parishioners. She could not help listening, though each new project was a stab to her heart. By the time the frost had set in, they should be far away from Hellstone. Old Simon's rheumatism might be bad and his eyesight worse, there would be no one to go and read to him, and comfort him with little porringers of broth and good red flannel, or if there was, it would be a stranger, and the old man would watch in vain for her. Mary Domville's little crippled boy would crawl in vain to the door and look for her coming through the forest. These poor friends would never understand why she had forsaken them, and there were many others besides. Papa has always spent the income he derived from his living in the parish. I am, perhaps, encroaching upon the next dues, but the winter is likely to be severe, and our poor old people must be helped.
"Oh, Mama, let us do all we can," said Margaret eagerly, not seeing the prudential side of the question, only grasping at the idea that they were rendering such help for the last time. "We may not be here long."
"Do you feel ill, my darling?" asked Mrs. Hale, anxiously, misunderstanding Margaret's hint of the uncertainty of their stay at Hellstone. "You look pale and tired. It is this soft, damp, unhealthy air."
"No, no, Mama, it is not that, it is delicious air. It smells of the freshest, purest fragrance, after the smokiness of Harley Street. But I am tired, it surely must be near bedtime."
"Not far off, it is 9:30. You had better go to bed at once, dear. Ask Dixon for some gruel. I will come and see you as soon as you are in bed. I am afraid you have taken cold, or the bad air from some of the stagnant ponds."
"Oh, Mama," said Margaret, faintly smiling as she kissed her mother, I am quite well, don't alarm yourself about me, I am only tired.
Margaret went upstairs. To soothe her mother's anxiety, she submitted to a basin of gruel. She was lying languidly in bed when Mrs. Hale came up to make some last inquiries and kiss her before going to her own room for the night. But the instant she heard her mother's door locked, she sprang out of bed, and throwing her dressing gown on, she began to pace up and down the room, until the creaking of one of the boards reminded her that she must make no noise. She went and curled herself up on the window seat in the small, deeply recessed window. That morning when she had looked out, her heart had danced at seeing the bright clear lights on the church tower, which foretold a fine and sunny day. This evening 16 hours at most had passed by. She sat down, too full of sorrow to cry, but with a dull cold pain, which seemed to have pressed the youth and buoyancy out of her heart, never to return. Mr. Henry Lennox's visit, his offer, was like a dream, a thing beside her actual life. The hard reality was, that her father had so admitted tempting doubts into his mind as to become a schismatic and outcast, all the changes consequent upon this grouped themselves around that one great blighting fact. She looked out upon the dark gray lines of the church tower, square and straight in the center of the view, cutting against the deep blue transparent depths beyond, into which she gazed, and felt that she might gaze forever, seeing at every moment some farther distance, and yet no sign of God. It seemed to her at the moment, as if the earth was more utterly desolate than if girt in by an iron dome, behind which there might be the ineffaceable peace and glory of the Almighty. Those never-ending depths of space, in their still serenity, were more mocking to her than any material bounds could be, shutting in the cries of earth's sufferers, which now might ascend into that infinite splendor of vastness and be lost forever, before they reached his throne. In this mood her father came in unheard. The moonlight was strong enough to let him see his daughter in her unusual place and attitude. He came to her and touched her shoulder before she was aware that he was there. "Margaret, I heard you were up. I could not help coming in to ask you to pray with me to say the Lord's Prayer, that will do good to both of us." Mr. Hale and Margaret knelt by the window seat, he looking up, she bowed down in humble shame. God was there, close around them, hearing her father's whispered words. Her father might be a heretic, but had not she, in her despairing doubts not 5 minutes before, shown herself a far more utter skeptic? She spoke not a word, but stole to bed after her father had left her, like a child ashamed of its fault. If the world was full of perplexing problems, she would trust, and only ask to see the one step needful for the hour. Mr. Lennox's visit, his proposal, the remembrance of which had been so rudely pushed aside by the subsequent events of the day, haunted her dreams that night. He was climbing up some tree of fabulous height to reach the branch whereon was slung her bonnet, he was falling, and she was struggling to save him, but held back by some invisible powerful hand. He was dead. And yet, with a shifting of the scene, she was once more in the Harley Street drawing room, talking to him as of old, and still with a consciousness all the time that she had seen him killed by that terrible fall. Miserable, unresting night. Ill preparation for the coming day. She awoke with a start, unrefreshed, and conscious of some reality worse even than her feverish dreams. It all came back upon her, not merely the sorrow, but the terrible discord in the sorrow. Where, to what distance apart, had her father wandered, led by doubts which were to her temptations of the evil one? She longed to ask, and yet would not have heard for all the world. The fine crisp morning made her mother feel particularly well and happy at breakfast time. She talked on, planning village kindnesses, unheeding the silence of her husband and the monosyllabic answers of Margaret. Before the things were cleared away, Mr. Hale got up, he leaned one hand on the table, as if to support himself. "I shall not be at home till evening. I am going to Bracy Common, and will ask Farmer Dobson to give me something for dinner. I shall be back to tea at 7. He did not look at either of them, but Margaret knew what he meant. By 7 the announcement must be made to her mother. Mr. Hale would have delayed making it till 6:30, but Margaret was of different stuff. She could not bear the impending weight on her mind all the day long. Better get the worst over, the day would be too short to comfort her mother. But while she stood by the window, thinking how to begin, and waiting for the servant to have left the room, her mother had gone upstairs to put on her things to go to the school. She came down ready equipped, in a brisker mood than usual. "Mother, come round the garden with me this morning, just one turn," said Margaret, putting her arm round Mrs. Hale's waist. They passed through the open window. Mrs. Hale spoke, said something Margaret could not tell what. Her eye caught on a bee entering a deep belled flower. When that bee flew forth with his spoil, she would begin, that should be the sign. Out he came. "Mama. Papa is going to leave Helstone," she blurted forth. "He's going to leave the church, and live in Milton Northern. There were the three hard facts hardly spoken.
What makes you say so? Asked Mrs. Hale, in a surprised incredulous voice. Who has been telling you such nonsense?
Papa himself, said Margaret, longing to say something gentle and consoling, but literally not knowing how. They were close to a garden bench. Mrs. Hale sat down, and began to cry.
I don't understand you, she said. Either you have made some great mistake, or I don't quite understand you.
No, Mother, I have made no mistake. Papa has written to the bishop, saying that he has such doubts that he cannot conscientiously remain a priest of the Church of England, and that he must give up Helstone. He has also consulted Mr. Bell Frederick's godfather, you know, Mama, and it is arranged that we go to live in Milton Northern.
Mrs. Hale looked up in Margaret's face all the time she was speaking these words, the shadow on her countenance told that she, at least, believed in the truth of what she said.
I don't think it can be true, said Mrs. Hale, at length. He would surely have told me before it came to this.
It came strongly upon Margaret's mind that her mother ought to have been told, that whatever her faults of discontent and repining might have been, it was an error in her father to have left her to learn his change of opinion, and his approaching change of life, from her better informed child. Margaret sat down by her mother, and took her unresisting head on her breast, bending her own soft cheeks down caressingly to touch her face.
Dear, darling Mama. We were so afraid of giving you pain. Papa felt so acutely, you know you are not strong, and there must have been such terrible suspense to go through.
When did he tell you, Margaret?
Yesterday, only yesterday, replied Margaret, detecting the jealousy which prompted the inquiry. Poor Papa! Exclamation mark, trying to divert her mother's thoughts into compassionate sympathy for all her father had gone through. Mrs. Hale raised her head.
What does he mean by having doubts? She asked.
Surely, he does not mean that he thinks differently, that he knows better than the church.
Margaret shook her head, and the tears came into her eyes, as her mother touched the bare nerve of her own regret.
Can't the bishop set him right? Asked Mrs. Hale, half impatiently.
I'm afraid not, said Margaret. But I did not ask. I could not bear to hear what he might answer. It is all settled at any rate. He is going to leave Helstone in a fortnight. I am not sure if he did not say he had sent in his deed of resignation.
In a fortnight! Exclaimed Mrs. Hale, I do think this is very strange, not at all right.
I call it very unfeeling, said she, beginning to take relief in tears. He has doubts, you say, and gives up his living, and all without consulting me. I dare say, if he had told me his doubts at the first, I could have nipped them in the bud.
Mistaken as Margaret felt her father's conduct to have been, she could not bear to hear it blamed by her mother. She knew that his very reserve had originated in a tenderness for her, which might be cowardly, but was not unfeeling.
I almost hoped you might have been glad to leave Helstone, Mama, said she, after a pause. You have never been well in this air, you know. You can't think the smoky air of a manufacturing town, all chimneys and dirt like Milton Northern, would be better than this air, which is pure and sweet, if it is too soft and relaxing. Fancy living in the middle of factories, and factory people. Though, of course, if your father leaves the church, we shall not be admitted into society anywhere. It will be such a disgrace to us. Poor dear Sir John. It is well he is not alive to see what your father has come to. Every day after dinner, when I was a girl, living with your Aunt Shaw, at Beresford Court, Sir John used to give for the first toast church and king, and down with the rump.
Margaret was glad that her mother's thoughts were turned away from the fact of her husband's silence to her on the point which must have been so near his heart. Next to the serious vital anxiety as to the nature of her father's doubts, this was the one circumstance of the case that gave Margaret the most pain.
You know, we have very little society here, Mama. The Gormans, who are our nearest neighbors, to call society, and we hardly ever see them, have been in trade just as much as these Milton Northern people.
Yes, said Mrs. Hale, almost indignantly, but, at any rate, the Gormans made carriages for half the gentry of the county, and were brought into some kind of intercourse with them, but these factory people, who on earth wears cotton that can afford linen?
Well, Mama, I give up the cotton spinners, I am not standing up for them, any more than for any other tradespeople. Only we shall have little enough to do with them.
Why on earth has your father fixed on Milton Northern to live in?
Partly, said Margaret, sighing, because it is so very different from Helstone, partly because Mr. Bell says there is an opening there for a private tutor.
Private tutor in Milton. Why can't he go to Oxford, and be a tutor to gentlemen? You forget, Mama. He is leaving the church on account of his opinions. His doubts would do him no good at Oxford. Mrs. Hale was silent for some time, quietly crying. At last she said, "Dash. And the furniture, how in the world are we to manage the removal? I never removed in my life, and only a fortnight to think about it." Margaret was inexpressibly relieved to find that her mother's anxiety and distress was lower to this point, so insignificant to herself, and on which she could do so much to help. She planned and promised, and led her mother on to arrange fully as much as could be fixed before they knew somewhat more definitively what Mr. Hale intended to do. Throughout the day Margaret never left her mother, bending her whole soul to sympathize in all the various turns her feelings took, towards evening especially, as she became more and more anxious that her father should find a soothing welcome home awaiting him, after his return from his day of fatigue and distress. She dwelt upon what he must have borne in secret for long. Her mother only replied coldly that he ought to have told her, and that then at any rate he would have had an adviser to give him counsel, and Margaret turned faint at heart when she heard her father's step in the hall. She dared not go to meet him, and tell him what she had done all day, for fear of her mother's jealous annoyance. She heard him linger, as if awaiting her, or some sign of her, and she dared not stir. She saw by her mother's twitching lips, and changing color, that she too was aware that her husband had returned. Presently he opened the room door, and stood there uncertain whether to come in. His face was gray and pale, he had a timid, fearful look in his eyes, something almost pitiful to see in a man's face, but that look of despondent uncertainty, of mental and bodily languor, touched his wife's heart. She went to him, and threw herself on his breast, crying out, "Oh! Richard, Richard, you should have told me sooner." And then, in tears, Margaret left her, as she rushed upstairs to throw herself on her bed, and hide her face in the pillows to stifle the hysteric sobs that would force their way at last, after the rigid self-control of the whole day. How long she lay thus she could not tell. She heard no noise, though the housemaid came in to arrange the room. The affrighted girl stole out again on tiptoe, and went and told Mrs. Dixon that Miss Hale was crying as if her heart would break. She was sure she would make herself deadly ill if she went on at that rate. In consequence of this, Margaret felt herself touched, and started up into a sitting posture. She saw the accustomed room, the figure of Dixon in shadow, as the latter stood holding the candle a little behind her, for fear of the effect on Miss Hale's startled eyes, swollen and blinded as they were. "Oh, Dixon! I did not hear you come into the room," said Margaret, resuming her trembling self-restraint. "Is it very late?" continued she, lifting herself languidly off the bed, yet letting her feet touch the ground without fairly standing down, as she shaded her wet ruffled hair off her face, and tried to look as though nothing were the matter, as if she had only been asleep. "I hardly can tell what time it is," replied Dixon, in an aggrieved tone of voice. "Since your mama told me this terrible news, when I dressed her for tea, I've lost all count of time. I'm sure I don't know what is to become of us all. When Charlotte told me just now you were sobbing, Miss Hale, I thought, no wonder, poor thing. And master thinking of turning dissenter at his time of life, when, if it is not to be said he's done well in the church, he's not done badly after all. I had a cousin, miss, who turned Methodist preacher after he was 50 years of age, and a tailor all his life, but then he had never been able to make a pair of trousers to fit, for as long as he had been in the trade, so it was no wonder, but for master. As I said to Mrs., what would poor Sir John have said? He never liked your marrying Mr. Hale, but if he could have known it would have come to this, he would have sworn worse oaths than ever, if that was possible." Dixon had been so much accustomed to comment upon Mr. Hale's proceedings to her mistress, who listened to her, or not, as she was in the humor, that she never noticed Margaret's flashing eye and dilating nostril. To hear her father talked of in this way by a servant to her face. "Dixon," she said, in the low tone she always used when much excited, which had a sound in it as of some distant turmoil, or threatening storm breaking far away. "Dixon. You forget to whom you are speaking." She stood upright and firm on her feet now, confronting the waiting maid, and fixing her with her steady discerning eye. "I am Mr. Hale's daughter. Go. You have made a strange mistake, and one that I am sure your own good feeling will make you sorry for when you think about it." Dixon hung irresolutely about the room for a minute or two. Margaret repeated, "You may leave me, Dixon. I wish you to go." Dixon did not know whether to resent these decided words or to cry. Either course would have done with her mistress, but, as she said to herself, "Miss Margaret has a touch of the old gentleman about her, as well as poor Master Frederick, I wonder where they get it from." And she, who would have resented such words from anyone less haughty and determined in manner, was subdued enough to say, in a half-humble, half-injured tone. "Mayn't I unfasten your gown, miss, and do your hair?"
"No. Not tonight, thank you." And Margaret gravely lighted her out of the room, and bolted the door. From henceforth Dixon obeyed and admired Margaret. She said it was because she was so like poor Master Frederick, but the truth was, that Dixon, as do many others, liked to feel herself ruled by a powerful and decided nature. Margaret needed all Dixon's help in action, and silence in words, for some time, the latter thought it her duty to show her sense of affront by saying as little as possible to her young lady, so the energy came out in doing rather than in speaking. A fortnight was a very short time to make arrangements for so serious a removal, as Dixon said, anyone but a gentleman, indeed almost any other gentleman, but catching a look at Margaret's straight, stern brow just here, she coughed the remainder of the sentence away, and meekly took the horehound drop that Margaret offered her, to stop the little tickling at my chest, miss. But almost anyone but Mr. Hill would have had practical knowledge enough to see, that in so short a time it would be difficult to fix on any house in Milton Northern, or indeed elsewhere, to which they could remove the furniture that had of necessity to be taken out of Helstone Vicarage. Mrs. Hill, overpowered by all the troubles and necessities for immediate household decisions that seemed to come upon her at once, became really ill, and Margaret almost felt it as a relief when her mother fairly took to her bed, and left the management of affairs to her. Dixon, true to her post of bodyguard, attended most faithfully to her mistress, and only emerged from Mrs. Hale's bedroom to shake her head, and murmur to herself in a manner which Margaret did not choose to hear. For, the one thing clear and straight before her, was the necessity for leaving Helstone. Mr. Hale's successor in the living was appointed, and, at any rate, after her father's decision, there must be no lingering now, for his sake, as well as from every other consideration. For he came home every evening more and more depressed, after the necessary leave-taking which he had resolved to have with every individual parishioner. Margaret, inexperienced as she was in all the necessary matter-of-fact business to be got through, did not know to whom to apply for advice. The cook and Charlotte worked away with willing arms and stout hearts at all the moving and packing, and as far as that went, Margaret's admirable sense enabled her to see what was best, and to direct how it should be done. But where were they to go to? In a week they must be gone. Straight to Milton, or where? So many arrangements depended on this decision that Margaret resolved to ask her father one evening, in spite of his evident fatigue and low spirits. He answered, "My dear, I have really had too much to think about to settle this. What does your mother say? What does she wish? Poor Maria." He met with an echo even louder than his sigh. Dixon had just come into the room for another cup of tea for Mrs. Hale, and catching Mr. Hale's last words, and protected by his presence from Margaret's upbraiding eyes, made bold to say, "My poor mistress." "You don't think her worse today," said Mr. Hale, turning hastily. "I'm sure I can't say, sir. It's not for me to judge. The illness seems so much more on the mind than on the body." Mr. Hale looked infinitely distressed. "You had better take Mama her tea while it is hot, Dixon," said Margaret, in a tone of quiet authority. "Oh. I beg your pardon, miss. My thoughts was otherwise occupied in thinking of my poor, of Mrs. Hale."
"Papa,"
said Margaret, "it is this suspense that is bad for you both. Of course, Mama must feel your change of opinions, we can't help that," she continued, softly, "but now the course is clear, at least to a certain point. And I think, Papa, that I could get Mama to help me in planning, if you could tell me what to plan for. She has never expressed any wish in any way, and only thinks of what can't be helped. Are we to go straight to Milton? Have you taken a house there?"
"No," he replied. "I suppose we must go into lodgings, and look about for a house.
And pack up the furniture so that it can be left at the railway station, till we have met with one?"
"I suppose so. Do what you think best. Only remember, we shall have much less money to spend."
They had never had much superfluity, as Margaret knew. She felt that it was a great weight suddenly thrown upon her shoulders. 4 months ago, all the decisions she needed to make were what dress she would wear for dinner, and to help Edith to draw out the lists of who should take down whom in the dinner parties at home. Nor was the household in which she lived one that called for much decision. Except in the one grand case of Captain Lennox's offer, everything went on with the regularity of clockwork. Once a year, there was a long discussion between her aunt and Edith as to whether they should go to the Isle of Wight, abroad, or to Scotland, but at such times Margaret herself was secure of drifting, without any exertion of her own, into the quiet harbor of home. Now,
Since that day when Mr. Lennox came and startled her into a decision, every day brought some question, momentous to her and to those whom she loved, to be settled. Her father went up after tea to sit with his wife. Margaret remained alone in the drawing room. Suddenly she took a candle and went into her father's study for a great atlas, and lugging it back into the drawing room, she began to pore over the map of England. She was ready to look up brightly when her father came downstairs. "I have hit upon such a beautiful plan. Look here in Darkshire, hardly the breadth of my finger from Milton, is Heston, which I have often heard of from people living in the north as such a pleasant little bathing place. Now, don't you think we could get Mama there with Dixon, while you and I go and look at houses, and get one all ready for her in Milton? She would get a breath of sea air to set her up for the winter, and be spared all the fatigue, and Dixon would enjoy taking care of her."
"Is Dixon to go with us?" asked Mr. Hale, in a kind of helpless dismay.
"Oh, yes," said Margaret. "Dixon quite intends it, and I don't know what Mama would do without her. But we shall have to put up with a very different way of living, I am afraid. Everything is so much dearer in a town. I doubt if Dixon can make herself comfortable. To tell you the truth, Margaret, I sometimes feel as if that woman gave herself airs."
"To be sure she does, Papa," replied Margaret, "and if she has to put up with a different style of living, we shall have to put up with her airs, which will be worse. But she really loves us all, and would be miserable to leave us, I am sure, especially in this change. So, for Mama's sake, and for the sake of her faithfulness, I do think she must go."
"Very well, my dear. Go on. I am resigned. How far is Heston from Milton? The breadth of one of your fingers does not give me a very clear idea of distance."
"Well, then, I suppose it is 30 miles, that is not much."
"Not in distance, but in—"
"Never mind. If you really think it will do your mother good, let it be fixed so." This was a great step. Now Margaret could work, and act, and plan in good earnest. And now Mrs. Hale could rouse herself from her languor, and forget her real suffering in thinking of the pleasure and the delight of going to the seaside. Her only regret was that Mr. Hale could not be with her all the fortnight she was to be there, as he had been for a whole fortnight once, when they were engaged, and she was staying with Sir John and Lady Beresford at Torquay.
Chapter 6. Farewell. Unwatched the garden bough shall sway, the tender blossom flutter down, unloved that beech will gather brown, the maple burn itself away. Unloved, the sunflower, shining fair, ray round with flames her disk of seed, and many a rose carnation feed with summer spice the humming air. Till from the garden and the wild a fresh association blow, and year by year the landscape grow familiar to the stranger's child. As year by year the laborer tills his wonted glebe, or lops the glades, and year by year our memory fades from all the circle of the hills. Tennyson. The last day came, the house was full of packing cases, which were being carted off at the front door, to the nearest railway station. Even the pretty lawn at the side of the house was made unsightly and untidy by the straw that had been wafted upon it through the open door and windows. The rooms had a strange echoing sound in them, and the light came harshly and strongly in through the uncurtained windows, seeming already unfamiliar and strange. Mrs. Hale's dressing room was left untouched to the last, and there she and Dixon were packing up clothes, and interrupting each other every now and then to exclaim at, and turn over with fond regard, some forgotten treasure, in the shape of some relic of the children while they were yet little. They did not make much progress with their work. Downstairs, Margaret stood calm and collected, ready to counsel or advise the men who had been called in to help the cook and Charlotte. These two last, crying between whiles, wondered how the young lady could keep up so this last day, and settled it between them that she was not likely to care much for Helstone, having been so long in London. There she stood, very pale and quiet, with her large grave eyes observing everything, up to every present circumstance, however small. They could not understand how her heart was aching all the time, with a heavy pressure that no sighs could lift off or relieve, and how constant exertion for her perceptive faculties was the only way to keep herself from crying out with pain. Moreover, if she gave way, who was to act? Her father was examining papers, books, registers, what not, in the vestry with the clerk, and when he came in, there were his own books to pack up, which no one but himself could do to his satisfaction. Besides, was Margaret one to give way before strange men, or even household friends like the cook and Charlotte? Not she. But at last the four packers went into the kitchen to their tea, and Margaret moved stiffly and slowly away from the place in the hall where she had been standing so long, out through the bare echoing drawing room, into the twilight of an early November evening. There was a filmy veil of soft dull mist obscuring, but not hiding, all objects, giving them a lilac hue, for the sun had not yet fully set. A robin was singing, perhaps, Margaret thought, the very robin that her father had so often talked of as his winter pet, and for which he had made, with his own hands, a kind of robin house by his study window. The leaves were more gorgeous than ever, the first touch of frost would lay them all low on the ground. Already one or two kept constantly floating down, amber and golden in the low slanting sun rays. Margaret went along the walk under the pear tree wall. She had never been along it since she pasted at Henry Lennox's side. Here, at this bed of time, he began to speak of what she must not think of now. Her eyes were on that late blowing rose as she was trying to answer, and she had caught the idea of the vivid beauty of the feathery leaves of the carrots in the very middle of his last sentence. Only a fortnight ago. And also changed. Where was he now? In London, going through the old round, dining with the old Harley Street set, or with gayer young friends of his own. Even now, while she walked sadly through that damp and drear garden in the dusk, with everything falling and fading, and turning to decay around her, he might be gladly putting away his law books after a day of satisfactory toil, and freshening himself up, as he had told her he often did, by a run in the Temple Gardens, taking in the while the grand inarticulate mighty roar of tens of thousands of busy men, nigh at hand, but not seen, and catching ever, at his quick turns, glimpses of the lights of the city coming up out of the depths of the river. He had often spoken to Margaret of these hasty walks, snatched in the intervals between study and dinner. At his best times and in his best moods had he spoken of them, and the thought of them had struck upon her fancy. Here there was no sound. The robin had gone away into the vast stillness of night. Now and then, a cottage door in the distance was opened and shut, as if to admit the tired laborer to his home, but that sounded very far away. A stealthy, creeping, crunching sound among the crisp fallen leaves of the forest, beyond the garden, seemed almost close at hand. Margaret knew it was some poacher. Sitting up in her bedroom this past autumn, with the light of her candle extinguished, and purely reveling in the solemn beauty of the heavens and the earth, she had many a time seen the light noiseless leap of the poachers over the garden fence, their quick tramp across the dewy moonlit lawn, their disappearance in the black still shadow beyond. The wild adventurous freedom of their life had taken her fancy, she felt inclined to wish them success, she had no fear of them. But tonight she was afraid, she knew not why. She heard Charlotte shutting the windows, and fastening up for the night, unconscious that anyone had gone out into the garden. A small branch it might be of rotten wood, or it might be broken by force came heavily down in the nearest part of the forest. Margaret ran, swift as Camilla, down to the window, and rapped at it with a hurried tremulousness which startled Charlotte within. "Let me in. Let me in. It is only me, Charlotte." Her heart did not still its fluttering till she was safe in the drawing room, with the windows fastened and bolted, and the familiar walls hemming her round, and shutting her in. She had sate down upon a packing case, cheerless, chill was the dreary and dismantled room, no fire nor other light, but Charlotte's long unsnuffed candle. Charlotte looked at Margaret with surprise, and Margaret, feeling it rather than seeing it, rose up. "I was afraid you were shutting me out altogether, Charlotte," said she, half smiling. "And then you would never have heard me in the kitchen, and the doors into the lane and churchyard are locked long ago." "Oh, miss, I should have been sure to have missed you soon. The men would have wanted you to tell them how to go on. And I have put tea in master's study, as being the most comfortable room, so to speak." "Thank you, Charlotte. You are a kind girl. I shall be sorry to leave you. You must try and write to me, if I can ever give you any little help or good advice. I shall always be glad to get a letter from Hailstone, you know. I shall be sure and send you my address when I know it." The study was all ready for tea. There was a good blazing fire, and unlighted candles on the table. Margaret sat down on the rug, partly to warm herself, for the dampness of the evening hung about her dress, and over-fatigue had made her chilly. She kept herself balanced by clasping her hands together round her knees, her head dropped a little towards her chest, the attitude was one of despondency, whatever her frame of mind might be. But when she heard her father step on the gravel outside, she started up, and hastily shaking her heavy black hair back, and wiping a few tears away that had come on her cheek she knew not how, she went out to open the door for him. He showed far more depression than she did. She could hardly get him to talk, although she tried to speak on subjects that would interest him, at the cost of an effort every time which she thought would be her last. "Have you been a very long walk today?" asked she, on seeing his refusal to touch food of any kind. "As far as Fordham Beeches. I went to see Widow Maltby, She is sadly grieved at not having wished you goodbye. She says little Susan has kept watch down the lane for days past.
Nay, Margaret, what is the matter, dear? The thought of the little child watching for her, and continually disappointed from no forgetfulness on her part, but from sheer inability to leave home, was the last drop in poor Margaret's cup, and she was sobbing away as if her heart would break. Mr. Hale was distressingly perplexed. He rose, and walked nervously up and down the room. Margaret tried to check herself, but would not speak until she could do so with firmness. She heard him talking, as if to himself.
I cannot bear it. I cannot bear to see the sufferings of others. I think I could go through my own with patience.
Oh, is there no going back?
No, Father, said Margaret, looking straight at him, and speaking low and steadily. It is bad to believe you in error. It would be infinitely worse to have known you a hypocrite. She dropped her voice at the last few words, as if entertaining the idea of hypocrisy for a moment in connection with her father savored of irreverence. Besides, she went on, it is only that I am tired tonight. Don't think that I am suffering from what you have done, dear Papa.
We can't either of us talk about it tonight, I believe, said she, finding that tears and sobs would come in spite of herself. I had better go and take Mama up this cup of tea. She had hers very early, when I was too busy to go to her, and I am sure she will be glad of another now.
Railroad time inexorably wrenched them away from lovely, beloved Helstone, the next morning. They were gone, they had seen the last of the long low parsonage home, half covered with china roses and pyracanthus more homelike than ever in the morning sun that glittered on its windows, each belonging to some well-loved room. Almost before they had settled themselves into the car, sent from Southampton to fetch them to the station, they were gone away to return no more. A sting at Margaret's heart made her strive to look out to catch the last glimpse of the old church tower at the turn where she knew it might be seen above a wave of the forest trees, but her father remembered this too, and she silently acknowledged his greater right to the one window from which it could be seen. She leant back and shut her eyes, and the tears welled forth, and hung glittering for an instant on the shadowing eyelashes before rolling slowly down her cheeks, and dropping, unheeded, on her dress. They were to stop in London all night at some quiet hotel. Poor Mrs. Hale had cried in her way nearly all day long, and Dixon showed her sorrow by extreme crossness, and a continual irritable attempt to keep her petticoats from even touching the unconscious Mr. Hale, whom she regarded as the origin of all this suffering. They went through the well-known streets, past houses which they had often visited, past shops in which she had lounged, impatient, by her aunt's side, while that lady was making some important and interminable decision, nay, absolutely past acquaintances in the streets, for though the morning had been of an incalculable length to them, and they felt as if it ought long ago to have closed in for the repose of darkness, it was the very busiest time of a London afternoon in November when they arrived there. It was long since Mrs. Hale had been in London, and she roused up, almost like a child, to look about her at the different streets, and to gaze after and exclaim at the shops and carriages. Oh, there's Harrison's, where I bought so many of my wedding things. Dear! How altered! They've got immense plate glass windows, larger than Crawford's in Southampton. Oh, and there, I declare no, it is not yes, it is Margaret, we have just passed Mr. Henry Lennox. Where can he be going, among all these shops? Margaret started forwards, and as quickly fell back, half smiling at herself for the sudden motion. They were 100 yards away by this time, but he seemed like a relic of Helstone. He was associated with a bright morning, an eventful day, and she should have liked to have seen him, without his seeing her, without the chance of their speaking. The evening, without employment, passed in a room high up in an hotel, was long and heavy. Mr. Hale went out to his booksellers, and to call on a friend or two. Everyone they saw, either in the house or out in the streets, appeared hurrying to some appointment, expected by, or expecting somebody. They alone seemed strange and friendless, and desolate. Yet within a mile, Margaret knew of house after house, where she for her own sake, and her mother for her aunt Shaw's, would be welcomed, if they came in gladness, or even in peace of mind. If they came sorrowing, and wanting sympathy in a complicated trouble like the present, then they would be felt as a shadow in all these houses of intimate acquaintances, not friends. London life is too whirling and full to admit of even an hour of that deep silence of feeling which the friends of Job showed, when they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Chapter 7. New scenes and faces. Mist clogs the sunshine, smoky dwarf houses have we round on every side. Matthew Arnold. The next afternoon, about 20 miles from Milton Northern, They entered on the little branch railway that led to Heston. Heston itself was one long straggling street, running parallel to the seashore. It had a character of its own, as different from the little bathing places in the south of England as they again from those of the continent. To use the Scotch word, everything looked more purpose-like. The country carts had more iron, and less wood and leather about the horse gear. The people in the streets, although on pleasure bent, had yet a busy mind. The colors looked grayer, more enduring, not so gay and pretty. There were no smock frocks, even among the country folk. They retarded motion, and were apt to catch on machinery, and so the habit of wearing them had died out. In such towns in the south of England, Margaret had seen the shopmen, when not employed in their business, lounging a little at their doors, enjoying the fresh air, and the look up and down the street. Here, if they had any leisure from customers, they made themselves business in the shop even, Margaret fancied, to the unnecessary unrolling and re-rolling of ribbons. All these differences struck upon her mind, as she and her mother went out next morning to look for lodgings. Their two nights at hotels had cost more than Mr. Hale had anticipated, and they were glad to take the first clean, cheerful rooms they met with that were at liberty to receive them. There, for the first time for many days, did Margaret feel at rest. There was a dreaminess in the rest, too, which made it still more perfect and luxurious to repose in. The distant sea, lapping the sandy shore with measured sound, the nearer cries of the donkey boys, the unusual scenes moving before her like pictures, which she cared not in her laziness to have fully explained before they passed away, the stroll down to the beach to breathe the sea air, soft and warm on that sandy shore even to the end of November, the great long misty sea line touching the tender colored sky, the white sail of a distant boat turning silver in some pale sunbeam, it seemed as if she could dream her life away in such luxury of pensiveness, in which she made her present all in all, from not daring to think of the past, or wishing to contemplate the future. But the future must be met, however stern and iron it be. One evening it was arranged that Margaret and her father should go the next day to Milton Northern, and look out for a house. Mr. Hale had received several letters from Mr. Bell, and one or two from Mr. Thornton, and he was anxious to ascertain at once a good many particulars respecting his position and chances of success there, which he could only do by an interview with the latter gentleman. Margaret knew that they ought to be removing, but she had a repugnance to the idea of a manufacturing town, and believed that her mother was receiving benefit from Heston Air, so she would willingly have deferred the expedition to Milton. For several miles before they reached Milton, they saw a deeply colored cloud hanging over the horizon in the direction in which it lay. It was all the darker from contrast with the pale gray blue of the wintry sky, for in Heston there had been the earliest signs of frost. Nearer to the town, the air had a faint taste and smell of smoke, perhaps, after all, more a loss of the fragrance of grass and herbage than any positive taste or smell. Quick they were whirled over long, straight, hopeless streets of regularly built houses, all small and of brick. Here and there a great oblong many-windowed factory stood up, like a hen among her chickens, puffing out black unparliamentary smoke, and sufficiently accounting for the cloud which Margaret had taken to foretell rain. As they drove through the larger and wider streets, from the station to the hotel, they had to stop constantly. Great loaded lorries blocked up the not over wide thoroughfares. Margaret had now and then been into the city in her drives with her aunt. But there the heavy lumbering vehicles seemed various in their purposes and intent. Here every van, every wagon and truck, bore cotton, either in the raw shape in bags, or the woven shape in bales of calico. People thronged the footpaths, most of them well dressed as regarded the material, but with a slovenly looseness which struck Margaret as different from the shabby, threadbare smartness of a similar class in London. "New Street," said Mr. Hale. "This, I believe, is the principal street in Milton. Phil has often spoken to me about it. It was the opening of this street from a lane into a great thoroughfare, 30 years ago, which has caused his property to rise so much in value. Mr. Thornton's mill must be somewhere not very far off, for he is Mr. Bell's tenant. But I fancy he dates from his warehouse. Where is our hotel, Papa?" "Close to the end of this street, I believe. Shall we have lunch before or after we have looked at the houses we marked in the Milton Times?" "Oh, let us get our work done first." "Very well. Then I will only see if there is any note or letter for me from Mr. Thornton, who said he would let me know anything he might hear about these houses, and then we will set off. We will keep the cab, it will be safer than losing ourselves, and being too late for the train this afternoon." There were no letters awaiting him. They set out on their house hunting. £30 a year was all they could afford to give, but in Hampshire they could have met with a roomy house and pleasant garden for the money. Here, Even the necessary accommodation of 2 sitting rooms and 4 bedrooms seemed unattainable. They went through their list, rejecting each as they visited it. Then they looked at each other in dismay.
"We must go back to the second, I think. That one, in Crampton, don't they call the suburb? There were 3 sitting rooms, don't you remember how we laughed at the number compared with the 3 bedrooms? But I have planned it all. The front room downstairs is to be your study and our dining room, poor Papa. For, you know, we settled Mama is to have as cheerful a sitting room as we can get, and that front room upstairs, with the atrocious blue and pink paper and heavy cornice, had really a pretty view over the plain, with a great bend of river, or canal, or whatever it is, down below. Then I could have the little bedroom behind, in that projection at the head of the first flight of stairs over the kitchen, you know, and you and Mama the room behind the drawing room, and that closet in the roof will make you a splendid dressing room.
But Dixon, and the girl we are to help?
Oh, wait a minute. I'm overpowered by the discovery of my own genius for management. Dixon is to have, let me see, I had at once the back sitting room. I think she will like that. She grumbles so much about the stairs at Heston, and the girl is to have that sloping attic over your room and Mama's. Won't that do?
I dare say it will. But the papers. What taste. And the overloading such a house with color and such heavy cornices.
Never mind, Papa. Surely, you can charm the landlord into repapering 1 or 2 of the rooms. The drawing room and your bedroom for Mama will come most in contact with him, and your bookshelves will hide a great deal of that gaudy pattern in the dining room.
Then you think it the best?
If so, I had better go at once and call on this Mr. Donkin, to whom the advertisement refers me. I will take you back to the hotel, where you can order lunch, and rest, and by the time it is ready, I shall be with you. I hope I shall be able to get new papers.
Margaret hoped so too, though she said nothing. She had never come fairly in contact with the taste that loves ornament, however bad, more than the plainness and simplicity which are of themselves the framework of elegance. Her father took her through the entrance of a hotel, and leaving her at the foot of the staircase, went to the address of the landlord of the house they had fixed upon. Just as Margaret had her hand on the door of their sitting room, she was followed by a quick-stepping waiter.
"I beg your pardon, ma'am. The gentleman was gone so quickly, I had no time to tell him. Mr. Thornton called almost directly after you left, and, as I understood from what the gentleman said, you would be back in an hour. I told him so, and he came again about 5 minutes ago, and said he would wait for Mr. Hale. He is in your room now, ma'am."
"Thank you. My father will return soon, and then you can tell him."
Margaret opened the door and went in with the straight, fearless, dignified presence habitual to her. She felt no awkwardness, she had too much the habits of society for that. Here was a person come on business to her father, and, as he was one who had shown himself obliging, she was disposed to treat him with a full measure of civility. Mr. Thornton was a good deal more surprised and discomfited than she. Instead of a quiet, middle-aged clergyman, a young lady came forward with frank dignity, a young lady of a different type to most of those he was in the habit of seeing. Her dress was very plain, a close straw bonnet of the best material and shape, trimmed with white ribbon, a dark silk gown, without any trimming or flounce, a large Indian shawl, which hung about her in long heavy folds, and which she wore as an empress wears her drapery. He did not understand who she was, as he caught the simple, straight, unabashed look, which showed that his being there was of no concern to the beautiful countenance, and called up no flush of surprise to the pale ivory of the complexion. He had heard that Mr. Hale had a daughter, but he had imagined that she was a little girl.
"Mr. Thornton, I believe," said Margaret, after a half-instant's pause, during which his unready words would not come. "Will you sit down? My father brought me to the door, not a minute ago, but unfortunately he was not told that you were here, and he has gone away on some business. But he will come back almost directly. I'm sorry you have had the trouble of calling twice."
Mr. Thornton was in habits of authority himself, but she seemed to assume some kind of rule over him at once. He had been getting impatient at the loss of his time on a market day, the moment before she appeared, yet now he calmly took a seat at her bidding.
"Do you know where it is that Mr. Hale has gone to? Perhaps I might be able to find him."
"He has gone to a Mr. Duncan's in Canute Street. He is the landlord of the house my father wishes to take in Crampton."
Mr. Thornton knew the house. He had seen the advertisement, and been to look at it, in compliance with a request of Mr. Bell's that he would assist Mr. Hale to the best of his power, and also instigated by his own interest in the case of a clergyman who had given up his living under circumstances such as those of Mr. Hale. Mr. Thornton had thought that the house in Crampton was really just the thing, but now that he saw Margaret, with her superb ways of moving and looking, he began to feel ashamed of having imagined that it would do very well for the Hales, in spite of a certain vulgarity in it which had struck him at the time of his looking it over. Margaret could not help her looks, but the short curled upper lip, the round, massive upturned chin, the manner of carrying her head, her movements, full of a soft feminine defiance, always gave strangers the impression of haughtiness. She was tired now, and would rather have remained silent, and taken the rest her father had planned for her, but, of course, she owed it to herself to be a gentlewoman, and to speak courteously from time to time to this stranger, not overbrushed, nor overpolished, it must be confessed, after his rough encounter with Milton streets and crowds. She wished that he would go, as he had once spoken of doing, instead of sitting there, answering with curt sentences all the remarks she made. She had taken off her shawl, and hung it over the back of her chair. She sat facing him and facing the light, her full beauty met his eye, her round white flexile throat rising out of the full, yet lithe figure, her lips, moving so slightly as she spoke, not breaking the cold serene look of her face with any variation from the one lovely haughty curve, her eyes, with their soft gloom, meeting his with quiet maiden freedom. He almost said to himself that he did not like her, before their conversation ended. He tried so to compensate himself for the mortified feeling, that while he looked upon her with an admiration he could not repress, she looked at him with proud indifference, taking him, he thought, for what, in his irritation, he told himself he was a great rough fellow, with not a grace or a refinement about him. Her quiet coldness of demeanor he interpreted into contemptuousness, and resented it in his heart to the pitch of almost inclining him to get up and go away, and have nothing more to do with these Hales, and their superciliousness. Just as Margaret had exhausted her last subject of conversation and yet conversation that could hardly be called which consisted of so few and such short speeches, her father came in, and with his pleasant gentlemanly courteousness of apology, reinstated his name and family in Mr. Thornton's good opinion. Mr. Hale and his visitor had a good deal to say respecting their mutual friend, Mr. Bell, and Margaret, glad that her part of entertaining the visitor was over, went to the window to try and make herself more familiar with the strange aspect of the street. She got so much absorbed in watching what was going on outside that she hardly heard her father when he spoke to her, and he had to repeat what he said. Margaret. The landlord will persist in admiring that hideous paper, and I am afraid we must let it remain. Oh dear. I am sorry. She replied, and began to turn over in her mind the possibility of hiding part of it, at least, by some of her sketches, but gave up the idea at last, as likely only to make bad worse. Her father, meanwhile, with his kindly country hospitality, was pressing Mr. Thornton to stay to luncheon with them. It would have been very inconvenient to him to do so, yet he felt that he should have yielded. If Margaret by word or look had seconded her father's invitation, he was glad she did not, and yet he was irritated at her for not doing it. She gave him a low, grave bow when he left, and he felt more awkward and self-conscious in every limb than he had ever done in all his life before. Well, Margaret, now to luncheon, as fast we can. Have you ordered it?
No, Papa, that man was here when I came home, and I have never had an opportunity.
Then we must take anything we can get. He must have been waiting a long time, I'm afraid.
It seemed exceedingly long to me. I was just at the last gasp when you came in. He never went on with any subject, but gave little, short, abrupt answers.
Very much to the point though, I should think. He is a clear-headed fellow. He said, did you hear? That Crampton is on gravelly soil, and by far the most healthy suburb in the neighborhood of Milton. When they returned to Heston, there was the day's account to be given to Mrs. Hale, who was full of questions which they answered in the intervals of tea drinking.
And what is your correspondent, Mr. Thornton, like?
Ask Margaret, said her husband. She and he had a long attempt at conversation, while I was away speaking to the landlord.
Oh. I hardly know what he is like, said Margaret, lazily, too tired to tax her powers of description much. And then rousing herself, she said, he is a tall, broad-shouldered man.
About how old, Papa?
I should guess about 30.
About 30, with a face that is neither exactly plain, nor yet handsome, nothing remarkable, not quite a gentleman, but that was hardly to be expected.
Not vulgar, or common though, put in her father, rather jealous of any disparagement of the sole friend he had in Milton.
Oh no, said Margaret, with such an expression of resolution and power, no face, however plain in feature,
could be either vulgar or common. I should not like to have to bargain with him, he looks very inflexible. Altogether a man who seems made for his niche, mama, sagacious, and strong, as becomes a great tradesman.
Don't call the Milton manufacturers tradesmen, Margaret, said her father. They are very different.
Are they? I apply the word to all who have something tangible to sell, but if you think the term is not correct, Papa, I won't use it.
But, oh Mama. Speaking of vulgarity and commonness, you must prepare yourself for our drawing room paper. Pink and blue roses, with yellow leaves. And such a heavy cornice round the room.
But when they removed to their new house in Milton, the obnoxious papers were gone. The landlord received their thanks very composedly, and let them think, if they liked, that he had relented from his expressed determination not to repaper. There was no particular need to tell them that what he did not care to do for a Reverend Mr. Hale, unknown in Milton, he was only too glad to do at the one short sharp remonstrance of Mr. Thornton, the wealthy manufacturer.
Chapter 8.
Homesickness.
And it's hame, fain wad I be.
It needed the pretty light papering of the rooms to reconcile them to Milton. It needed more that could not be had. The thick yellow November fogs had come on, and the view of the plain in the valley, made by the sweeping bend of the river, was all shut out when Mrs. Hale arrived at her new home. Margaret and Dixon had been at work for 2 days, unpacking and arranging, but everything inside the house still looked in disorder, and outside a thick fog crept up to the very windows, and was driven into every open door in choking white wreaths of unwholesome mist.
"Oh, Margaret. Are we to live here?" asked Mrs. Hale in blank dismay. Margaret's heart echoed the dreariness of the tone in which this question was put. She could scarcely command herself enough to say, "Oh, the fogs in London are sometimes far worse." But then you knew that London itself, and friends lay behind it.
Here well. We are desolate.
Oh Dixon, what a place this is.
Indeed, ma'am, I'm sure it will be your death before long, and then I know who'll stay.
Miss Hale, that's far too heavy for you to lift.
Not at all, thank you, Dixon, replied Margaret, coldly.
The best thing we can do for Mama is to get her room quite ready for her to go to bed, while I go and bring her a cup of coffee.
Mr. Hale was equally out of spirits, and equally came upon Margaret for sympathy.
Margaret, I do believe this is an unhealthy place. Only suppose that your mother's health or yours should suffer.
I wish I had gone into some country place in Wales, this is really terrible, said he, going up to the window.
There was no comfort to be given. They were settled in Milton, and must endure smoke and fogs for a season, indeed, all other life seemed shut out from them by as thick a fog of circumstance.
Only the day before, Mr. Hale had been reckoning up with dismay how much their removal and fortnight at Heston had cost, and he found it had absorbed nearly all his little stock of ready money.
No. Here they were, and here they must remain.
At night when Margaret realized this, she felt inclined to sit down in a stupor of despair. The heavy smoky air hung about her bedroom, which occupied the long narrow projection at the back of the house. The window, placed at the side of the oblong, looked to the blank wall of a similar projection, not above 10 feet distant. It loomed through the fog like a great barrier to hope. Inside the room everything was in confusion. All their efforts had been directed to make her mother's room comfortable. Margaret sat down on a box, the direction card upon which struck her as having been written at Helstone Beautiful, beloved Helstone. She lost herself in dismal thought, but at last she determined to take her mind away from the present, and suddenly remembered that she had a letter from Edith which she had only half-read in the bustle of the morning. It was to tell of their arrival at Corfu, their voyage along the Mediterranean, their music, and dancing on board ship, the gay new life opening upon her, her house with its trellised balcony, and its views over white cliffs and deep blue sea. Edith wrote fluently and well, if not graphically. She could not only seize the salient and characteristic points of a scene, but she could enumerate enough of indiscriminate particulars for Margaret to make it out for herself. Captain Lennox and another lately married officer shared a villa, high up on the beautiful precipitous rocks overhanging the sea. Their days, late as it was in the year, seemed spent in boating or land picnics, all out of doors, pleasure-seeking and glad. Edith's life seemed like the deep vault of blue sky above her, free, utterly free from fleck or cloud. Her husband had to attend drill, and she, the most musical officer's wife there, had to copy the new and popular tunes out of the most recent English music, for the benefit of the bandmaster, those seemed their most severe and arduous duties. She expressed an affectionate hope that, if the regiment stopped another year at Corfu, Margaret might come out and pay her a long visit.
She asked Margaret if she remembered the day 12 months on which she, Edith, wrote how it rained all day long in Harley Street, and how she would not put on her new gown to go to a stupid dinner, and get it all wet and splashed in going to the carriage, and how at that very dinner they had first met Captain Lennox.
Yes. Margaret remembered it well. Edith and Mrs. Shaw had gone to dinner. Margaret had joined the party in the evening. The recollection of the plentiful luxury of all the arrangements, the stately handsomeness of the furniture, the size of the house, the peaceful, untroubled ease of the visitors all came vividly before her, in strange contrast to the present time. The smooth sea of that old life closed up, without a mark left to tell where they had all been. The habitual dinners, the calls, the shopping, the dancing evenings, were all going on forever, though her Aunt Shaw and Edith were no longer there, and she, of course, was even less missed. She doubted if anyone of that old set ever thought of her, except Henry Lennox. He too, she knew, would strive to forget her, because of the pain she had caused him. She had heard him often boast of his power of putting any disagreeable thought far away from him. Then she penetrated farther into what might have been. If she had cared for him as a lover, and had accepted him, and this change in her father's opinions and consequent station had taken place, she could not doubt but that it would have been impatiently received by Mr. Lennox. It was a bitter mortification to her in one sense, but she could bear it patiently, because she knew her father's purity of purpose, and that strengthened her to endure his errors, grave and serious though in her estimation they were. But the fact of the world esteeming her father degraded, in its rough wholesale judgment, would have oppressed and irritated Mr. Lennox. As she realized what might have been, she grew to be thankful for what was. They were at the lowest now, they could not be worse. Edith's astonishment and her Aunt Shaw's dismay would have to be met bravely, when their letters came. So Margaret rose up and began slowly to undress herself, feeling the full luxury of acting leisurely, late as it was, after all the past hurry of the day. She fell asleep, hoping for some brightness, either internal or external. But if she had known how long it would be before the brightness came, her heart would have sunk low down. The time of the year was most unpropitious to health as well as to spirits. Her mother caught a severe cold, and Dixon herself was evidently not well, although Margaret could not insult her more than by trying to save her, or by taking any care of her. They could hear of no girl to assist her, all were at work in the factories, at least, those who applied were well scolded by Dixon, for thinking that such as they could ever be trusted to work in a gentleman's house. So they had to keep a charwoman in almost constant employ. Margaret longed to send for Charlotte, but besides the objection of her being a better servant than they could now afford to keep, the distance was too great. Mr. Hale met with several pupils, recommended to him by Mr. Bell, or by the more immediate influence of Mr. Thornton. They were mostly of the age when many boys would be still at school, but, according to the prevalent, and apparently well-founded notions of Milton, to make a lad into a good tradesman he must be caught young, and acclimated to the life of the mill, or office, or warehouse. If he were sent to even the Scotch universities, he came back unsettled for commercial pursuits, how much more so if he went to Oxford or Cambridge, where he could not be entered till he was 18. So most of the manufacturers placed their sons in sucking situations at 14 or 15 years of age, unsparingly cutting away all offshoots in the direction of literature or high mental cultivation, in hopes of throwing the whole strength and vigor of the plant into commerce. Still there were some wiser parents, and some young men, who had sense enough to perceive their own deficiencies, and strive to remedy them. Nay, there were a few no longer youths, but men in the prime of life, who had the stern wisdom to acknowledge their own ignorance, and to learn late what they should have learned early. Mr. Thornton was perhaps the oldest of Mr. Hale's pupils. He was certainly the favorite. Mr. Hale got into the habit of quoting his opinions so frequently, and with such regard, that it became a little domestic joke to wonder what time, during the hour appointed for instruction, could be given to absolute learning, so much of it appeared to have been spent in conversation. Margaret rather encouraged this light, merry way of viewing her father's acquaintance with Mr. Thornton, because she felt that her mother was inclined to look upon this new friendship of her husband's with jealous eyes. As long as his time had been solely occupied with his books and his parishioners, as at Helstone, she had appeared to care little whether she saw much of him or not. But now that he looked eagerly forward to each renewal of his intercourse with Mr. Thornton, she seemed hurt and annoyed, as if he were slighting her companionship for the first time. Mr. Hale's overpraise had the usual effect of overpraise upon his auditors; they were a little inclined to rebel against Aristides being always called the just. After a quiet life in a country parsonage for more than 20 years,
There was something dazzling to Mr. Hale in the energy which conquered immense difficulties with ease. The power of the machinery of Milton, the power of the men of Milton, impressed him with a sense of grandeur, which he yielded to without caring to inquire into the details of its exercise. But Margaret went less abroad, among machinery and men, saw less of power in its public effect, and, as it happened, she was thrown with one or two of those who, in all measures affecting masses of people, must be acute sufferers for the good of many. The question always is, has everything been done to make the sufferings of these exceptions as small as possible? Or, in the triumph of the crowded procession, have the helpless been trampled on, instead of being gently lifted aside out of the roadway of the conqueror, whom they have no power to accompany on his march?